From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the particle at the end of the universe. An incredible story. Well, we had our Coast to Coast chat tonight with the Coast Insiders. Had a great time. Just passed on some great information and a number of guest ideas for the future. Coast Insiders, part of CoastToCoastAM.com. Here's what's happening. Residents of the state of Louisiana have filed an online petition with the White House to secede from the United States, and now residents in at least 39 additional states have filed similar requests with the White House to peaceably break away from the Union. In a moment, Drew Zahn joins us from WorldNet Daily. It's an incredible story about what might be happening here in the United States. But what's happening in Mississippi? The state where babies are less likely to reach their first birthday than in any other state, according to the most recent data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. For every 1,000 Mississippi babies born in 2011, 9.4 died from their very first birthday, according to state health office. That makes Mississippi's infant mortality rate more comparable to countries such as Costa Rica, Sri Lanka, Botswana. Mississippi leads the nation in obesity. That could be a major factor, which can carry a host of complications that might affect the baby, such as hypertensive disorders, according to doctors there. An Arizona woman in despair at the re-election of President Barack Obama ran down her husband with a family car in suburban Phoenix on Saturday because he failed to vote in the election. The 28-year-old woman was arrested. He's in critical condition at a local hospital. A Tulsa man has been arrested after police found his 18-month-old daughter locked in a metal dog cage and the older daughter outside on a cold afternoon while he was asleep in a drug or alcohol-induced stupor. A Canadian man who is believed to have been in a vegetative state for more than a decade has now been able to tell scientists that he is not in any pain. It's the first time an uncommunicative, severely brain-injured patient has been able to give answers clinically relevant to the care. Well, if you're into technology, you're going to love this story. The storage capacity of hard disk drives could increase by a factor of 5 thanks to processes developed by chemists and engineers at the University of Texas at Austin. The researchers' technique, which relies on self-organizing substances known as block copolymers, were described this week in an article in Science. It's also being given a real-world test run in collaboration with one of the world's leading innovators in disk drives. Lauren Weinstein with us, expert on all these things. Well, computers just keep getting better and better and better, Lauren.
Yeah, and this story really, really is amusing because I remember when I started working with these systems at UCLA, the disk drives that we had, for like a 100 megabyte, we're not saying gigabyte, disk drive, was considered really, really large. And they cost about $100,000, and they were the size of like an oven with the disk pack being over a foot, a foot wide and a big, it looked like a big cake holder, actually, with lots of platters in it. And now we're talking about this kind of technology. And what they're really saying with this polymer system that they've developed is they're trying to get out from under some fundamental limits in physics when you're talking about magnetism. You make the particles smaller and smaller and smaller. Eventually, they won't hold their magnetic state anymore. They flip between 0 and 1. Uncontrollably, and that isn't really good for storing data. So this new technique may allow, and so far it's testing out pretty well apparently, to get maybe 5 times now, who knows how much later, more capacity by using new styles of techniques that don't rely on the traditional magnetic methods. So really, really the sky's the limit. The other thing that's interesting about this is that while everyone's very interested in solid state memory, like the memory cards and things, and you always hear people saying, well, these are going to completely replace disks. And in some applications, they are, especially big data centers and things like that, and in small consumer devices, too. We keep seeing the capacity of disks getting bigger and bigger and bigger also, and on a cost-per-bit basis, disks continue to be the winner. So I think we're going to keep seeing these spinning disks around for a long time to come.
All right, Lauren, thank you so much. It's great technology, and eventually I'm sure it'll be added to smartphones as well. As I mentioned, residents in 40 states now, they want to secede from the union. We're going to be talking with Drew Zahn about that in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Drew Zahn, a reporter, of course, with one of the news editors at WND.com, the nation's largest independent online news source, a graduate of Bethel University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Drew is a former pastor who cut his editing teeth as a member of the award-winning staff of leadership. And he's with us now to talk about this incredible story he wrote for WND, Secession. Drew, this is an amazing story. How are you, by the way? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing very well. Thank you for talking to me this evening.
So we've got, first of all, this is not mandated by the state governments. These are individuals. These are citizens of the states who are signing a petition that the White House has made available. Tell me about all that, that process.
Well, the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, one of the lesser-known rights that it gives us is the right to petition the government for grievances and so forth. And what happened was, some time ago, the Obama White House established a web page to help people do this. Basically, you register on the web page and you can create a petition inviting other people to sign it to petition the government. And basically, what the White House has done is said, well, if they can get 25,000 signatures, online signatures, to these petitions, then they pledge to put it in a list of questions that they will pledge to answer. Starting there, the day after the election, a guy down in Louisiana, all we know is his name is Michael E. We don't have his full name because it's not available on the website. He's from Slidell, Louisiana. The day after the election, he decided to file one of these petitions. And the petition he filed was that the state of Louisiana, where he lives, would be permitted to peaceably secede from the union. Now, that's where it started.
Okay, now...
From there. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we've had similar things happen on this program. We had a guest who had a petition on for UFO disclosure, as a matter of fact. And, you know, they tried to get the petition, and they had one that got enough, but the White House kind of like shoved it under the door. Do they have, if they get they've got enough signatures here. Drew, will the White House do anything with this or just toss it away?
The White House has pledged to put it on a list of things they will answer. Will they actually follow through on that pledge or not? Well, I suppose that depends on how much trust you have in the Obama administration.
All right, now for actual states to secede from the union, what must they attempt to do?
Well, there's actually, and I was doing a bit of research on this prior to the show, there's three different ways that a state could theoretically leave the union. Two of them are not really controversial. Through the years, Supreme Court decisions and various presidents and scholars agree that two of these are perfectly legal. One is for the other states to let the seceding state go. Another way is for violent revolution, like what we did in the American Revolution, 1776. Mm-hmm. But then there's this third way, and this is a much more controversial, and that's the issue of secession. Can a state actually just say, that's it, we don't want to be part of the United States anymore? That's quite a bit more controversial. It's been debated in the early 1800s. It was debated even before that with the writing of the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation before that. And obviously we had a real big debate in the country right about 1860 on the topic, fought a war over it.
Well, we sure did. You know, we saw what happened many years ago with the Soviet Union, where the countries that they all had kind of broke up and the entire thing fell apart. Do you think that government would allow any of the states to secede?
Well, I sure don't think they would like, you know, I don't think they would be willing to. I think you're going to see the current administration, I imagine, this is my speculation, but I think they're going to punt on this. I think they're going to try to, as you said earlier, shove it under the rug and ignore it. However, it's getting harder and harder to ignore. There are, by last count earlier this afternoon, there were over 530,000 signatures cumulatively on these 40 different states' petitions. They're wanting to secede peacefully. Now, this is what makes it interesting, though, because they are asking the federal government. They are asking for a peaceful secession. And so that really kind of falls under that third category that everyone agrees in terms of Supreme Court decisions and so forth is perfectly legal, and that is if the federal government will let a state go.
Drew, in your opinion, tell me about the unrest, the unhappiness that would even have residents even consider wanting this to happen.
Well, one of the clues we have to what's going on is the wording of some of the petitions themselves. Take, for example, and I'm going to grab this quick and okay. quote it directly, the Texas petition, which, by the way, is the one that has the most signatures. I'm going to actually quote it here, what the Texas petition says. It says, the U.S. continues to suffer economic difficulties stemming from the federal government's neglect to reform domestic and foreign spending. The citizens of the U.S. suffer from blatant abuses of their rights, such as the NDAA, the TSA, etc. Now, given that the state of Texas maintains a balanced budget and is the 15th largest economy in the world, it's practically feasible for Texas to withdraw from the Union. And to do so would protect its citizens' standards of living and resecure their rights and liberties in accordance with the original ideals and beliefs of our founding fathers, which are no longer being reflected by the federal government. End quote. Now, there's several clues in there. One, they talk about the finances. We're looking at a lot of people in this country who are seeing that $16 trillion debt, are seeing our value of our dollar being, you know, trashed. We're seeing future generations being saddled with a debt that doesn't look like it's payable, that are seeing our national sovereignty because of that financial debt being ceded out to China and to other places. And then when they talk about later in there, they talked about the original ideas and beliefs of our founding fathers, resecuring our rights. We've obviously had a big controversy in the country just recently with religious rights and Obamacare infringing on that. And that's really a fundamental right. You know, it's one thing to argue on some of the finer points, but when we're talking about the freedom of religion, we're talking about the freedom of speech, I mean, these are the First Amendment type rights, and those are going to become contentious. Those are going to get trampled upon. Those are the very kinds of things that led the men and women in 1776 to do something drastic.
This is an amazing story, Drew. Let's use Texas again as an example. So if for some strange reason they seceded, all the federal, let's say, gasoline taxes that they pay in Texas, they wouldn't have to pay to the federal government, right?
Well, if they were able to successfully do it, you're absolutely right. Those taxes wouldn't even exist in the state of Texas anymore. Texas would essentially have to rewrite whatever gasoline taxes they may or may not want to have. And if they did continue with the gasoline taxes, they would stay in Texas. They certainly wouldn't go to D.C.
Would they be a separate company? I mean, would a country? Would it be the country of Texas?
That is exactly what they would be, yes.
Amazing. Truly strange story. Now, give me the odds. Do you think this could happen?
Well, one of the things, you know, I don't think that in 1860, the people suddenly in South Carolina, which was the first state to secede, I don't think they suddenly, you know, woke up in 1860 and had a meeting, got together, and somebody raised their hand and said, I think we should secede. And then everybody else said, oh, okay, never thought of that one before, let's do it. That's not how it happened. They were talking about secession. They had citizen petitions just like this in regards to secession years, decades ahead of time. It started small, and it bubbled and it bubbled and it bubbled until we had the election of 1860, which was essentially the last straw, and the people voted to secede. Now, what we have right now, basically, are, well, as of this afternoon, 533,000 bubbles.
It's a slow burn, isn't it?
Well, it's got to start somewhere if it's going to happen. And what we're seeing is those seeds, those early warning signs, those first steps are happening.
Let me ask you this, Drew. I mean, it was a close election in terms of the popular vote. The president, of course, outdistanced Mitt Romney there, came up strong at the end, was very strong with the electoral votes. So, but we're still a country divided. You know, it was very, very close. It wasn't 50-50, but again, pretty darn close. So are we talking about a public relations move here by the 50% of the citizens of this country who are just unhappy with the fact that their person did not win, and so they're just doing this? They're signing the petition?
I think that that trivializes it, and I think that also misrepresents it. It's not just a PR move, and it's not just about people unhappy with one election. We can look back, and really you look all the way back to 1860 and before, there is a pattern of a federal government growing bigger and stronger and more invasive and more intrusive, growing more and more irresponsible in terms of how it manages the things that are entrusted to it. And those are the major issues that these petitions are bringing up. I didn't see a single petition that said Barack Obama, you know, won and our guy lost, so we want out. I don't see that.
Okay.
What I see them saying is our rights are being trampled upon. Our country is no longer operating under the constitutional guidelines that it was set up for, and so we believe that. And then they quote the Declaration of Independence. And that's where you start to realize that there's something else going on here.
What would happen?
Election, but
well, here's a bizarre question. Let's say Texas secedes. Let's say China wants Texas. They send in an army. What are we going to do about it as a federal government? Let's assume Texas is the only state that's done that. I mean, what's going to happen? Are we going to let China move in and take over Texas?
Well, if Texas were to become a separate nation, then the United States would have to interact with Texas like they do any other foreign nation. There would be a foreign policy. And we have certain allies around the world. For example, if China pulled that same maneuver with Great Britain or with Israel right now, I imagine the U.S., you know, military would have something to say about that.
That's true.
I would assume that Texas would be, especially given its proximity, considered an ally of the U.S. That seems like smart foreign policy to me. So, yes, Texas would be required to, you know, if they're going to be their own country, they've got to have their own army for self-defense. But at the same time, the U.S. would be there. I mean, the U.S. got awfully upset when the Russians tried to come into Cuba. So if the Chinese tried to come into Texas, I imagine that'd be a problem, too.
And I agree with you, Drew. I think what this is a slow burn that could create an issue, not today, but sometime tomorrow. And I think if the federal government doesn't recognize the concerns of the people, something's going to happen down the line. Would you think that would probably be the case?
I think your assessment is spot on. These issues continue to get worse. In many respects, they're not getting better. And that means people are going to begin looking to more and more, you know, significant ways of speaking out, of taking action. And right now they're petitioning the White House. What is that going to get? Well, at most, that's going to get a response from the White House, which really isn't that big of a deal. But if that response that is received is incredibly unsatisfactory, then I wouldn't be surprised if these same petitioners turn around and go to their state legislatures. Now, once you start doing that, now you're moving the ball down the field. You're rolling the snowball a little bit here, and you could see more and more things happen if this sentiment, if this belief that the federal government is trashing the Constitution and violating civil rights, is violating God-given fundamental rights, you've got basically, again, the seeds of the same spirit that fueled the revolution of 1776.
All right, we're going to take some phone calls with you, Drew. When we come back, I want you to react to this story. If you want to read the story, we've got it linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Drew, if you have the list, it might be easier to tell our listeners the states, the 10 states that haven't had people sign a petition. Do you have that, or do you need me to read all 40?
Well, you know what I might just do is recommend people visit the site and see for themselves, because it's been updating. You know, since I wrote this article, it's possible even more states are added. So I would recommend people visit petitions.whitehouse.gov. There you can see a list of the open petitions, and there's 100 and some petitions on there. At least 40 of them are these states.
You know, with a president, of course, who is going to, you know, play out his remaining 4 years, you know, maybe the first term this would have affected him. I'm not sure now it would. What do you think?
Well, you know, some have called this president sort of Teflon. You know, there's a lot of things that could stick to him but seem to slide right off. So I don't see that these petitions themselves are going to, you know, sort of rock the foundations in Washington.
Right.
The question is what's going to happen when these 500,000 people, or however many signed these by now, start getting active, start feeling like their voices aren't being heard. You know, what's going to happen? I imagine it was a lot fewer than 500,000 who started that first revolution back in 1776.
Should they be petitioning their legislatures rather than the White House?
Well, if they want to see action, yeah, ultimately that's the direction you have to go. And I don't think you're going to get a whole lot of movement out of the White House. But if you have a state where the rumbling starts getting serious, then you might see some kind of more significant response. You might see a state actually, you know, make some sort of movement. But you're right. It's at the state level that you're probably going to see something tangible actually happen.
Okay, let's get your reaction or your questions. Let's go to Carl, truck driving in Texas on the wild card line. You're first. Hi, Carl. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I just wanted to say, you know, people, when we were in school, we were taught, you know, slavery was the issue of the Civil War. Actually, the first states that succeeded from the Union succeeded because their taxes were going to Washington and the representation was not there. They weren't getting any benefit. Actually, Lincoln, the first general that he wanted to lead the Northern Army to make the states come back into the Union was General Lee, and he was from Virginia. And General Lee sent a letter back and said, this is the act of a madman, basically. I'm paraphrasing. But, you know, what person would send troops against its own citizens, you know? I mean, that's the thing we've been taught, you know, that was the thing in back then, you know. But that's the same thing that they did back then that we're doing now. You know,
and Carl, let me ask you this, too. 80,000 people in the state of Texas, they want this. They want to secede. How do you feel about that?
I feel like it's great. I mean, you know, if that's the thing that the federal government has done, it has took away all of the power of the state. They want to control it all. Where states were supposed to have their individual power, the federal government has stepped in and said, no, we're the supreme power. We dictate what happens in your state. And that's what brought about the secession the first time, was because the South, their money was going, and, you know, it's a North-South thing back then, of course, you know, but the money that was coming from cotton was king in the South. There was a lot of industry around cotton in the South. Tax money was going to Washington, and it benefited the North. It didn't come back South, any of the benefit from the federal government. And that's why states said, okay, we've had enough of this. Now, slavery was put on later on because they said, look, there's relatives in the North. There's relatives in the South. These people from the North are not going to go fight the people in the South. That's their relatives. That's their kinmen. That's their countrymen. If you don't put slavery on the table and do it that way, we're not ever going to have people go down there and try to make them come back into the Union. That's where slavery came about. And, you know, the thing about it is, you know, I mean, I drive the highways of this country, and the road system and everything else, the money that I pay in fuel taxes should be going back into the roadways, and I can't even hardly hold on to the truck sometimes.
Well, I know the feeling. I've driven on freeways, and I think sometimes my tire's going to fall off. Carl, thanks for that. I like your insight there. Might this be a wake-up call, Drew, to the federal government? Here's an example. States of Washington, of course, they decide in Colorado, they say, hey, let's legalize a small amount of marijuana. The federal government is still going to crack down on anybody who uses it. Do you think the federal government might say, hey, it's time for us to back away from the states on most of these issues?
It's going to take a significant reversal of momentum. The federal government has been growing in power and growing in intrusiveness and trampling over, maybe using too strong a language, other people would say not strong enough, but has been overtaking states' powers now for literally hundreds of years. Now that we see some states, whether it's the marijuana laws or whether it's Obamacare regulations that certain states are resisting, as states start to kind of this dying last gasp, say, wait a minute, we don't want the federal government controlling everything. I don't see the federal government just saying, oops, sorry, we've been wrong all along.
Let's go to Randy, Phoenix, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Randy, you're on with Drew Zahn. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much for letting me be on the air. I just got off the phone with Jan Brewer, our governor in the state of Arizona. First of all, I know of no state legislatures, either does she, that have sent in a petition for the state of Arizona.
No, I don't see Arizona, at least right now, I don't see Arizona.
They have. There's already a petition started. This is online petitions. Many people from different states are signing multiple petitions. Texas has now 85,000 signatures.
That's right.
Now, I know of no governor or any state legislature that has sent any of this into the White House. The other thing that you have mentioned is that Texas is a balanced budget. First of all, last year, Perry got $24.2 billion from the federal government through stimulus money for the state of Texas. Plus, he gets $6.4 billion a year from the federal government normally. Now, if the state of Texas has got such a balanced budget, why didn't they give us $30 billion to the federal government? Why instead of taking it back into their own state from the federal treasury? Can you answer that?
I can't. What about you, Drew?
Well, as far as the balance of the budget goes, that was the claim of the person who signed the petition. The other issue that the caller brings up, though, is legitimate. We are talking now. We're not talking about any legislatures who are taking any action.
Well, we've said that.
We're not talking about any state officials. We're just talking about individuals these states who are making these petitions.
And maybe the mistake the White House did was putting on this technique for petitions.
Well, they created an opportunity for the discussion to happen, that's for sure.
You know, they sure did. They sure did. Randy, thanks for your call. Let's go to Josh, Athens, Alabama, first-time caller. Josh, go ahead. You're on with us.
Howdy, Mr. Norrie. How wonderful it is to get to talk to you.
All right. Thank you.
My question pertained to this massive list of people who signed their name to want to succeed from the union. Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen when these people can't get on a plane because they're on a no-fly list? But I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
I mean, that would be interesting if they become their own countries. Will they need passports to enter the rest of the United States, Drew?
Almost certainly. Yes, we're talking about completely different nations. And by the way, just to add it, something we haven't had a chance to talk about just yet, there are also a couple of counter petitions on that same White House website.
Okay.
A couple of folks have started petitions saying that if you have signed one of these petitions, you ought to have your citizenship revoked and you ought to be deported from the country. So clearly there's some divergence of opinions.
Let's go to Drew in Albany, Georgia. Drew, you're on with Drew. Go ahead.
Hey, I've been noticing today all the Facebook chatter on there. A lot of people denigrating people, like you was just saying, by posting the anti-petitions, basically. And the thing I've been hearing people talk about for a while is, you know, if the economy goes to crap here and everything crashes, we might naturally see this happen with the states saying basically, you know, we're fed up with this and, you know, we can't survive because of the economy, and separating into possibly four or five different factions of the United States. Like they would get together for states that would cooperate, say like Florida, Georgia, Alabama, a couple other states, you know, the West Coast, maybe five states. We might actually see the United States split up into four or five different factions.
Well, that's always a possibility. There's no doubt about that. I mean, what if some states say, hey, we want to join Canada or we want to join Mexico? Is that conceivable, Drew?
Yeah, that's conceivable. I think the situation that the caller may be looking forward to is, well, not looking forward, but seeing down the road, is the possibility that we've got a federal government with a debt that has hit $16 trillion and little ability to repay that debt. If the federal government stops sending the money, can't give the money to the states anymore, the states could hit panic mode. And if they do that, who knows what could happen?
Well, that's true. State of Washington we go. It's David's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, David. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Love the show, as always. I've been hearing talk about this all day on talk radio, and one thing I think is statistically it's insignificant. They say, oh, it's 40 states and all these people in there. If you went to the states and could actually poll people, you would find people would be horrified at the idea of seceding from the United States. I think this also would be completely different, despite the claim that it has nothing to do with Obama, had Romney won. And had Romney won, we would have been hearing conservatives talking about, oh, yes, the United States has spoken and given a mandate, and we're going to do these sweeping changes now. And yet we don't hear that being said about Obama from the conservative side of the coin. But the one more interesting thing I think about it is I think about, you know, back in the days of the hippies, when I was a little kid, the line was, you know, the anti-hippie line was, America, if you don't like it, leave it. I feel that way about America now, and I'm a screaming liberal. And these people, 500,000 people supposedly across America sitting around grumbling and going about and saying, we need to secede. I would like them to pack their bags and leave, because I think that they actually weakened the country instead of working for the betterment of everybody, for the greatest country in the world, in my opinion. And I'm a liberal saying that. So that's my thoughts on it. And I just think it's ridiculous and highly humorous. And I look forward to hearing more about the story. I'll get off the air now so someone else can get on.
All right. Super. Well, you know what? I've always said, spending 9 years in the Navy, Drew, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not leaving this country. I'm not running away. And I'm sticking right here. And I would hope all these states do the same thing. But like you said, it's an unrest. It's a slow burn. It's like putting a frog in a little pot and you just cook him slowly. I think it's at a point where people are saying enough is enough. Let's start doing something for the people. Let's start doing something for the states. This, I think, is a wake-up call.
Well, certainly. And, you know, again, the caller talked about people, you know, would they be willing to leave the country? Yeah, that's what secession is. That's exactly what they're talking about. They're saying, yes, I'm ready to pack my bags. I'm ready to leave. I need some land. I need somewhere where I can go and do that. And can enough of us get together in one place to do that, whether that's Texas or somewhere else? If they're serious about signing the petition, they're serious about saying, yeah, we really do believe that we can do better than the current federal government is doing in the United States.
It's Eric Stern, truck driving in Missouri, going east. Hey, Eric, go ahead.
How you doing, George? How you doing,
good,
Drew?
Sir. Very good.
Thank you. Hey, when you're all talking about this secession, Texas is in the driver's seat for this because they're the only state that joined the Union that was another country in 1847. All the rest of us were territories. And so when they joined the Union in 1847, they had a stipulation that they could leave anytime they wanted.
I wonder how many people know about that little tiny clause.
Yeah, if you think about it, when we was a young country, we was all territories, Missouri Territory, the Wyoming Territory, and we had governorships. And Texas was its own country because it was the Lone Star. And when they joined in 1847, they was already a country. They wasn't a state. They was their own country because they took it from the Mexicans after the Alamo. And see, there was already a country in then joined with us, and just like like you were saying, the Soviet bloc, see, they had their own little countries and they took them over. But Texas joined us, and they had in their stipulation, if we ever want to leave this union, we can. And so they all have to do is their legislator has to come up and say, well, our people are disgruntled with it, with the United States. We're leaving. And there's not a thing the United States can do about it.
Look in your crystal ball, Drew. How's this all going to unfold?
Well, you know, everything that he just said about Texas having been an independent country, that much is accurate. However, the stipulation that they can leave anytime they want to, I was reading just recently that that's a little bit of an urban myth. Now, I think some more research should be done on that before pronouncing it fully one way or the other. But as I look ahead, crystal ball, what I see is once you give these people a forum and a place to get together and a place to get talking, they may well band it together. And it's that kind of banding together that it's not just an individual out here or out there, but we're talking tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And obviously, there's all the people who haven't heard about this yet. Once they start getting together and talking, they become politically powerful and can actually affect some sort of change. That is what makes this topic so significant. It's not just some petition that got signed somewhere and that's all there is to it. No, it is the seeds of a growing movement. People starting to do things, starting to get serious enough to say, yeah, I really wish I could leave the United States. That's significant.
Would you say that most of the people who have signed these petitions would be on the conservative side and probably didn't vote for this president?
I suspect that's the case. And the initial petition came the day after the election. There's, you know, clue number one. Clue number two is that most of these petitions refer to the Declaration of Independence. That kind of looking back at our founding documents is certainly something that conservatives are more likely to do than liberals. So I'm guessing, you know, that you're seeing that. However, a number of these petitions are coming out of what we call blue states. So I don't know whether those are disenfranchised people who lost in their state or whether they're simply citizens we're seeing in one way or another, again, a federal government that is infringing now not only on states' rights, but individual rights as well.
You know, I feel this way, Drew, for example, about people who burn the American flag, that, you know, they have a right to do that because of our system of government. We've allowed you to do that. We've allowed your freedom of expression and speech. Go ahead, and if you want to burn the flag, go burn it. But I sure would love for them to leave the country. If they're going to burn the flag of the United States, then you know what? Get out. In this particular case, they don't want to leave the entire area. They just want to leave the federal government.
Well, again, I think when you talk about America, you have to ask yourself, what America are we talking about? These are people who, at least according to what they're professing in their petitions, are people who hold to the principles that the Founding Fathers laid down for America. That's the America that they're appealing to. That's the America they want to live in. And what they're saying is this current America, this current Washington, D.C., is not that America. They would love to wave the flag. They would love to be proud to be an American, except that America that they love so much, they're not seeing reflected in reality in D.C.
Drew, thank you for spending the hour with me. Fascinating. 40 states where people are petitioning. The states aren't doing this, but the people are. They want to secede. I don't think it'll happen. The Particle at the End of the Universe, that's next on Coast to Coast AM. Researchers at the Large Hadron Collider have detected one of the rarest particle decays seen in nature. The finding deals a significant blow to the theory of physics known as supersymmetry, and many researchers had hoped that the LHC would have confirmed this by now. Supersymmetry has gained popularity as a way to explain some of the inconsistencies in the traditional theory of subatomic physics known as Standard Model. Now, what does that all mean? Well, we're going to talk about that and also the particle at the end of the universe. Next up, Sean Carroll joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. You know, we've talked a lot on this program about the Higgs boson, the God particle, but what does it mean? truly, what does it mean? Well, let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Sean Carroll, Ph.D., theoretical physicist at California's Institute of Technology, noted author as well, also wrote the book From Eternity to Here. After receiving his doctorate from Harvard University, he pursued research on particle physics, cosmology, gravitation. He's one of the founders of the group blog Cosmic Variance, and here is Sean Carroll on Coast to Coast back again. Sean, how are you?
Good. How are you doing, George?
Good. All is well. All is well indeed. Lots of exciting things going on in the world of physics, huh?
Yeah, it's a great time to be thinking about, you know, the fundamental constituents of the universe. We've had a very good year here.
We did. A home run indeed. Look, was the Large Hadron Collider worth the billions of dollars it cost to build?
Well, obviously you're asking me. I'm going to say, yes, it absolutely was. It does cost a lot of money. There's no question, and we should admit that. But it's over the course of many, many years, and it's from many, many countries that are contributing to it. And what we get for it is, in some sense, priceless. You know, a piece of knowledge about how the world works that would otherwise there simply be no way to get. It's not like if you spend half as much money, you get half a Higgs boson. If you spend half as much money, you wouldn't discover anything new at all.
What is truly the Higgs boson? You know, we've heard about this God particle for several years now. I don't think any one of us, outside of you, can explain what it means.
You know, I'm quick to admit that it is hard to explain it because, not because it's hard to understand, but because it requires two steps. There's what really matters to us is not the Higgs boson, but something called the Higgs field that fills space. You probably have heard this story that when you just see light from a light bulb, light is an electromagnetic wave, right? So you have electric fields and magnetic fields, and they're vibrating, and those vibrations are traveling from the light bulb to your eyeballs. But you probably also heard that we can think about that light as particles, as photons of light. So the Higgs is exactly the same way. There's a field filling space called the Higgs field. And the bosons that we detect, these particles, are just the little vibrations in that field. And all of that is a warm-up of saying that what we care about is the Higgs field that fills space much more than the Higgs boson, which is just evidence that the field is really there.
How did scientists even know to start looking for all of this?
Well, that's a great question, because this is a real triumph of how we do physics. It was back in the 1960s, in 1963 and 1964, physicists were stuck with this problem of understanding the nuclear forces, what holds protons and neutrons together in the nucleus of an atom. And there are two nuclear forces, the strong and the weak. And in the early 60s, we didn't really know anything about them. We had a lot of data. Our understanding was very, very poor. So a whole bunch of ideas were flying around. And one idea was, well, maybe it's a lot like electricity and magnetism, but somehow electrical fields and magnetic fields can stretch across the room, and these nuclear force fields are really short range. They don't stretch outside the nucleus. If you have two protons and they're far away, they'll be pushed apart because they're both positively charged, and same charged particles repel each other. But if they get very, very close, then that strong nuclear force kicks in and pulls them together. So the physicists were like, well, how can we make a version of this electromagnetic force that we understand so well, but one that is short range? And the answer that they came up with, just by thinking about it hard, is if there was some field filling the universe that as we travel through it, you know, as we walk through the room or if we travel through interstellar space, if this field is all around us, interacting with all of our particles, it can cut off the nuclear force. It can make it perfectly effective over short ranges, but die off so you don't notice it over long ranges. And it was an audacious idea. I mean, you know, sure, maybe that's it. Maybe there's lots of other things. But that idea seemed to fit together really well. And the prediction that that idea made was, well, this field, it's going to have vibrations in it, and those vibrations are going to show up as a new particle of nature. And now, 45 years later or more, we've actually found the thing. We knew what we were looking for. We've looked for it for decades, and it's finally showed up. And some of these physicists were there. They're 80 years old now. They were in the room, and you know, it's a very emotional moment when the discovery was announced this July. They broke down a little bit because it's sometimes hard to believe an idea you had half a lifetime ago. People spent $1 billion chasing, and now there it is.
The fact that it exists, what does that mean?
Well, it means that we understand how the particles that make us up work. That's, you know, it's an audacious way to put it, but that's how it is. You know, we had this theory for a long time of all the. So in 1960s, we didn't understand the strong and weak nuclear forces, and then by 10 years later, we had an excellent theory of both the strong force and the weak force. And the one missing ingredient that we hadn't detected was this Higgs boson, which would tell us that the Higgs field was really there. If you take our understanding of particle physics and you imagine there was no such thing as the Higgs field, then particles like electrons that make up, you know, the outer part of your atoms, and electrons do everything for us, right? Everything electronic is electrons moving around. Atoms are electrons surrounding the nuclei. All of chemistry is electrons talking to each other. And if it weren't for the Higgs, these electrons would be massless. Would they be like photons? They'd be moving at the speed of light. They wouldn't stick together in atoms. There wouldn't be any chemistry. There wouldn't be any planets or stars. There would not be you or me. So without the Higgs field, the universe doesn't make sense to us at all. And that doesn't mean that it's there, right? We have to actually go out and find it. That's how physics works. And now we think we found it.
It sure sounds like somebody designed this pretty smartly.
Somebody's. There's a lot of people. You know, probably a total of 10,000 people in one way or the other have been involved with the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. And, you know, there's two giant experiments working on it. And both experiments have over 3,000 collaborators. So every time they get a result and they publish a paper, there's 3,000 authors on the paper. And this is something the whole community has to do. You know, particle physics has become such a big enterprise that no one country can do it, including the United States. You know, we had a big particle accelerator plan ourselves, the superconducting supercollider in Texas, and we gave up and closed it down because we couldn't afford it.
Now, have we found the Higgs boson or not? Because, you know, I know they said that they found a Higgs-like particle, but have we found the God particle?
Yeah, it depends on how picky you want to be. I'm happy to go either way. We found a particle. That's absolutely clear. It has all of the properties we would have expected the Higgs boson to have. But we did just detect it very shortly ago. So, you know, like anything new, we haven't learned everything there is to know about it yet. So we're still not 100% sure that it's precisely the original idea, or maybe it's some variation that we're not sure of yet. So that's going to be a big program for years now, is studying the properties of this new discovery we've made. And all of the physicists in the world are hoping that it's not the original Higgs boson, that it's something we haven't quite thought of yet that teaches us something new. That's how we make progress.
Did Einstein know about this, about the Higgs boson?
He did not. He passed away in the 1950s. And our understanding of elementary particle physics at the time was very, very poor. You know, it was just a mess. In fact,
right.
There's a very good story that is told by Leon Lederman. Leon Lederman is the Nobel Prize-winning experimental particle physicist who actually coined the term God particle. He's still around today, but when he was young, when he was a graduate student, it was in the 1950s. And he was working at Columbia in New York City, and he and his friend went down to Princeton to visit Einstein. And it wasn't like, you know, an official set-up seminar or anything like that. They basically stalked him. They waited outside his office at the Institute for Advanced Study to bump into him, quote-unquote, accidentally. And they finally did, and they were talking to him, and he was very polite to them. And, you know, he said, explain to me what you're doing. And they said, oh, we're doing these experiments to discover new particles. And Einstein nodded and patiently, and then he said, that is not interesting. Bye, boys. And then he walked away. So this is not Einstein's cup of tea, the whole particle physics game.
Had he been around now, what would he be doing?
That's a great question. You know, I don't want to speak for Einstein. In his early days, he was a very mainstream thinker in the sense that he was working on the questions that everyone was interested in. He was right there in the center of the action. And he was a little bit smarter than everybody else, so he got there first with relativity and things like that. And he kept up, you know, his involvement in mainstream science his whole life, but he was so successful as a youngster in sort of single-handedly revolutionizing the field that he never felt the need to work on the things that everyone else thought was interesting after that time. So he went his own way, and he tried to construct this unified theory of all the forces of nature. And the one of the reasons why he didn't succeed is we didn't know what all the forces of nature were at that time. So it might be that if he were alive today, he would be working on one of the attempts that we have to unify the forces, like superstring theory, for example. I mean, he was a brilliant theoretical physicist. He was not an experimenter. He didn't have a lab. He didn't tinker around. Like me and like many others, he sat in his office with a pencil and paper and wrote down equations and tried to figure out how things could possibly make sense. So I suspect he'd be doing quantum field theory, superstring theory, something like that. But, you know, he was Einstein, so he was very smart. He might have surprised us all.
Maybe so. Maybe so. With the knowledge of the Higgs boson, what does that do to an individual in their day-to-day life, Sean?
Nothing at all, unless they want to know how the world works. The whole quest for the Higgs boson is not fundamentally about technology or our everyday lives. You know, 100 years ago, there was no difference between doing fundamental physics and doing applied physics. They were discovering things like electromagnetism and quantum mechanics and lasers and semiconductors and all these wonderful things. But we've reached the point now where, again, we understand basic physics well enough to do all the technology that we want to do. And this new stuff we're discovering, the Higgs boson, or if we discover the dark matter and so forth, we do not anticipate any technological applications at all. We could be surprised, of course. You know, we've got to be open-minded. We're not very good at predicting the future. But that's not why we do it. We do it because we really want to understand the guts of our universe. And, of course, along the way, in order to do that, we have to build something like the Large Hadron Collider, the largest machine ever built. And in doing that, we have enormous technological obstacles to overcome, and we keep inventing new things that do have tremendous everyday technological applications. The most famous example by far is a little thing you might have heard of called the World Wide Web.
Oh, yeah.
This was invented at CERN, at the Particle Physics Laboratory in Geneva, where they discovered the Higgs boson, because the first people who needed the ability to share files back and forth effortlessly were particle physicists. And so they invented this thing called the web, which has turned out to be pretty useful. And, you know, likewise, many computer advances, technology advances, superconductivity and so forth, have come out of doing particle physics. So it's not that the Higgs boson gets us direct technological benefits, but the search for the Higgs boson certainly does.
Well, with Sean Carroll, of course, his new work, The Particle at the End of the Universe. What's the difference, Sean, between a theoretical physicist and just a physicist?
Well, it's a big difference in a field like particle physics, where there's almost nobody who works simultaneously as a world-class theoretical physicist and as a world-class experimental physicist. The field has become very, very specialized because there's just so much knowledge you need to do either one of those that it's very difficult to master both. So a theoretical physicist sits around and says something like, okay, you know, here's the Higgs boson data that we have. Let me try to build a model that is consistent with this data but goes beyond what we know. So maybe I can write down a new theory that explains both the Higgs boson we see and the dark matter that we haven't yet seen. Or maybe I can write down a new theory where the Higgs boson is actually a composite of two different particles, just like protons and neutrons are composites of quarks and gluons. Whereas an experimentalist isn't writing down models, is not chasing equations to make new predictions, so much as building equipment, carrying out these experiments, collecting data, analyzing the data, making these technological breakthroughs we talked about, and really making the discoveries that push the theoretical physicists in the right direction.
Sean, if we were to have a powerful microscope, so powerful that we could get down to the most minute first stage particle, whatever it might be, as you look at a human body and you see the body and you see the cell level and it gets smaller and smaller. What is that very first particle?
Yeah, wouldn't I like to know? That would be awesome.
we don't know that, huh?
We don't know that. No, certainly not.
But there's got to be the very first one down there, right?
Well, you know, I suspect that there is, but I'm too cautious to say there's got to be because we don't know the answer. And historically, human beings have had a very bad track record at saying something must be true before we've actually showed that it is the case.
Well, let me ask you this. Let me rephrase it. Uh-huh. What is the smallest known particle we know of so far?
Well, the set of particles that belong to what we call the Standard Model of Particle Physics. So that's things like electrons and neutrinos and the quarks and also the Higgs boson, the photon, the force-carrying particles. All of these, as far as we can tell, have no internal structure. They are point-like particles. They are in some sense of zero size. Now, there's a little bit fuzziness there because of quantum mechanics. You know, you can't actually pin the particle down to zero size because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. But we don't know of any particles smaller than these. But at the same time, we are very, very aware that our understanding is incomplete. So it may be that these are fundamental particles, or it may be that we just haven't looked at small enough distances yet. Like you said, our microscopes aren't quite good enough yet to tell whether they're truly fundamental.
It's amazing thinking of the complexity and at the same time, the simplicity of all of this. I mean, it seems like it goes both ways, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The whole history of physics is that we study things and they're puzzling and we don't know what's going on and things get more complicated and weirder and we're scratching our heads and then suddenly a great idea comes along and we go, oh, yeah, now all that makes sense. And this is exactly what was happening in the 50s and 60s, this explosion of data from accelerators. We were discovering all these new particles, and we didn't know how they fit together. There was this joke made by Willis Lamb, who was a Nobel Prize winner in the late 1950s. He said, it used to be if you discovered a new elementary particle, you won the Nobel Prize. Nowadays, they discover so many that discovering a new particle should get you a $10,000 fine. But then, in the 1960s, we invented quarks. And in fact, there's a very small number of quarks, but they fit together in many different combinations. And suddenly, all of those particles we had been discovering made sense to us. They were just different configurations of quarks. So we're hoping the same thing happens at some time in the future. We have, you know, a picture of the world with four forces, one Higgs boson, six quarks, and six leptons, and it fits all the data. It's just too messy to be the right final answer. So all of us are trying to think of a simple, compelling model that would spill out and explain all of this complexity.
Why did so many countries collaborate on the Large Hadron Collider?
It's a fascinating story, actually. It was after World War II when Europe, you know, had been decimated right and left, and a few far-reaching physicists wanted to sort of restart physics in Europe. And, you know, they thought it would be a good project to pull people together and pool the resources of all of Europe's countries, or at least Western Europe at that time. And so they founded this laboratory, which we now call CERN, the Center European Research Nuclear, was the original acronym. It's in French. So this is outside Geneva on the border of France and Switzerland, and it's ever since the 1950s, CERN has been the center for particle physics in Europe, and the Europeans decided early on that in order to compete with the United States, they would have to pool their resources. It was not going to be, you know, England or Germany or France individually.
Hold on, Sean. Let's come back to that story in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Sean Carroll, physicist. We're talking about his work, The Particle at the End of the Universe. And we'll come back and talk more with him about this on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Sean Carroll with us. Sean, The Particle at the End of the Universe. And the book just came out, didn't it?
Today was release day, yeah.
How about that for timing, huh?
Very well done, yes.
Can paint us a picture. What does the Large Hadron Collider at CERN look like, and how does it work?
Yeah, it's a tremendous technological achievement, the largest machine ever built. It's in a tunnel underground, so you go down 330 feet. If you're standing on the surface, you know, above the collider, it would just look like a pastoral setting, a field. There'd be cows, mountains in the distance, the French Alps. And underneath, there's a tunnel that goes 17 miles around in a circle. And inside this tunnel, there are these magnets that are incredibly powerful. And they take these particles, the protons that make up, you know, people like you and me. They strip off the electrons. It's just the protons. And they're zipping around at 99.9999999% the speed of light. And they smash them together at the experimental points along the ring, which are these giant machines, much, much bigger than a human being, much bigger than a bus or, you know, the size of a cathedral, basically. And the energy from these collisions creates new particles which spread out. And they have incredibly fast and adept technological apparatus that detects the different particles, tells us what they are, and then we reconstruct what happened. And it's so much data. You know, if you actually took all the data that was created at the Large Hadron Collider and tried to save it to a hard drive, you know, within minutes, you would fill up more data than the largest database in the world. So you pick and choose. You try to look for the really interesting collisions, the really interesting interactions, and keep those. And it's been working like clockwork. There was a few hiccups when it first started going in 2008, but starting in 2009, it's been performing flawlessly.
Well, it's an amazing piece of machinery. How did somebody even conceive of it in terms of structuring it and how to build it?
Yeah, you know, it happens gradually. You know, it happens, the idea of sort of particles circling around and colliding grew up very gradually over the 20th century. We know that if you put a charged particle in a magnetic field, it will circle around. So that part we understood. And getting them to collide was a whole other thing. There was a Nobel Prize given basically just for figuring out how to stabilize the beams of particles to get them to collide with each other. And so there's a history of many different accelerators built over the years, both at CERN in Geneva and also places like Fermilab here in the United States outside Chicago and the Stanford Linear Accelerator in California, the Brookhaven Accelerator in Long Island. But now the Large Hadron Collider is way above everything else in terms of energy and technology and so forth. And so we're just drawing on decades and lifetimes of experience in building these incredibly precise machines.
Sean, we were talking about the more than 100 countries that collaborated on CERN, and you were telling us how this all came about. Let's go through that again.
Yeah, it was, you know, the attempt to get European physics rolling after World War II. So they founded this laboratory, and they've done an amazing job at cooperating, the European countries, over the years. And, you know, the United States has not been a very good international partner. It tends to start things and then stop them and, you know, changes its mind and so forth. But and it went through some tough times. The, you know, the Large Hadron Collider got started officially 1993, and that's about the time that Europe was struggling with reunification, right? You know, Germany was coming back together, the Berlin Wall falling and so forth. And it was not a time when the countries of Europe were very interested in spending money on particle physics, let's put it that way. But the management of CERN managed to convince everybody that it was worth doing, and it's been an amazing story since then.
How should I feel? Because I don't know much about the universe. I'm still trying to figure out who we are, how we started,
okay, yes.
and what it all means. I mean, should I feel like a fool, or are we all in the same boat here?
You should feel like an eager customer for buying my book, George. Come on, that's the obvious
that's
thing to
right.
make you feel a whole bit much better educated. But no, you know, I think that there's two things that are going on. One is that every one of us is a lot smaller than the universe, and you know, we should not feel humbled by the fact that we haven't figured it all out yet. Whether we're a particle physicist or a Buddhist monk or anybody out there listening. It's just a very complicated universe we're in, and what's amazing is that we have figured out as much of it as we have. So we're all very tiny and ignorant compared to the whole universe. On the other hand, We're all part of the universe. We're all made of the same particles that are described by the standard model of particle physics. And it is understandable. It's alien in some way, which is not surprising, because the world of particles is a very different regime than our everyday lives. You know, we are several feet tall. You know, we move around in a world in a certain set of speeds and so forth. And now we're talking about particles moving close to the speed of light that are incredibly tiny, that are governed by the rules of relativity and quantum mechanics. And it's a weird world, the world of particles. So it's not surprising that it seems strange to us, but it's absolutely understandable by anyone who makes the effort. And I don't mean like learning all the equations and all that. I just mean, right, you know, following the literature, the blogs, reading a couple books, watching a couple of TV shows, watch Morgan Freeman through the wormhole and so forth. And I think it's a very participatory thing. We're discovering new things about nature, and everyone has the right to follow along for the ride and see how it's going.
In the scheme of things, is it a wonderment that it's here, that the universe exists, or is this something that you think was just going to happen?
Well, that's a good question to which I don't know the answer. One of the great things about doing physics at this level is that we know a lot, but we also know exactly where the boundary is between what we know and what we don't know. And so that's on the don't know side, questions about why is there something rather than nothing. We don't even know whether that's a good question, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Is there an explanation for why the universe was here, or does it just happen, or did we just get lucky? Is it just an accident? I don't think we're allowed to demand either way. I don't think that, you know, when people say, well, obviously the universe just happened, you know, there's no deeper reasoning than that, or when other people say, obviously there must be an explanation for the universe and then, you know, we need to find it. We don't know either one of those things. I think we need to be open-minded about it, wait for our theoretical understanding to catch up to what we know. And until then, we should keep an open mind.
Well, there's no doubt about that. What about dark matter? What the heck is that?
Dark matter is a great topic because it is absolutely the next target after we found the Higgs boson. There's no question in my mind that dark matter exists. It's something that is not described by the standard model of particle physics. So you and me and the Earth and the Sun and the stars, these are all described by the standard model, quarks, leptons, the forces that we know. But we know enough about those particles to know that none of them are the dark matter. And we know the dark matter is there. We've detected its gravitational field. We can see its effect on light traveling through the universe and on stars orbiting galaxies over and over again. We can see very clearly and without a shadow of a doubt that dark matter is exerting a force. But we don't know what it is. We have plenty of theories. It's not hard to come up with an idea. People like me are fully employed, you know, writing down equations that describe new ideas about what the dark matter could be. And many of them predict that we should be able to find it pretty soon. We have a very robust experimental program that is looking for the dark matter. So it won't be completely dark anymore if our ideas are correct.
Universe, they say, almost 14 billion years old. How do they get these numbers, Sean?
Well, we that's a happy achievement that we didn't have when I was a graduate student. You know, 20 years ago, we really didn't know. We had, you know, 10 billion, 15 billion, anywhere in there was okay. The idea is simply that the universe is expanding. It's getting bigger. We can look at distant galaxies, and they're moving away from us. So if you play the clock backwards, everything was closer together in the past. And when things are closer together, they're pulling on each other even faster. So the universe was expanding faster and faster as you go further and further into the past. So what you need is some theory, some model of the universe that lets you extrapolate from today backward. And we have that now. We didn't have it when I was growing up, but, you know, now that we know about dark matter and also something called dark energy, we have the basic ingredients to play the movie backwards and say, okay, how old does the universe have to be in this model to fit all the data we have? How fast is expanding? What the structure in the universe looks like? What the leftover radiation from the Big Bang looks like? And the answer is it needs to be 13.7 billion years old. If it were a little bit older or a little bit younger, it wouldn't fit the data that we have.
Okay, before that 13.7 billion years old,
mm-hmm.
What was there? What happened?
I don't know. I don't know. I have a theory, my own theory. I think that our universe came out of a bigger universe. I think that the universe...
You may be right.
Again, we should be open-minded. One possibility is the universe just started 13.7 billion years ago. There was no such thing as before that moment. Another possibility is that it was a phase. The Big Bang was sort of a moment in time, but there was another moment before that and more moments after that. I mean, to fit everything together, and the universe could be infinitely old. And I actually think that that story hangs together quite well and is more promising, but I'm very ready to admit that I don't have the final answer yet.
Could we have been popped through a wormhole?
Something like that. I think that's, the kind of idea that is on the table, that, there was a space that was just empty space that was existing for a long time, not doing very much of anything, quietly sitting there. But quantum mechanics says that there are fluctuations. There's unpredictable random events that happen. And so maybe one unpredictable random event could be a wormhole opening up and popping out a new universe, and there we are. That is something that we are absolutely taking seriously.
Sean, I know you're a scientist, but are you at a point where you would say you've got to add in an ingredient that we're just not aware of, whether it's consciousness, divine, intelligence, something is out there that has helped contribute to all this? Can you say that as a scientist?
Yeah, personally, I don't think that's true, actually. I think that we've been so successful at understanding as much as we have about the universe just based on the laws of nature as we are discovering them without external influences of any sort, that my bet is that's going to be the way we continue to go. The amazing thing about the universe is that it is able to come up with all of the wonderful complexity of the world that we see around us. Just the idea of a radio station, okay? It was not obvious if you look at what the universe was like 13.7 right. billion years ago. But it's the many, many, many tiny incremental steps of evolution just following the laws of nature that have led us here to this incredible complexity that we see around us. So my personal bet is that that program is going to continue to be more and more successful, and we'll have a purely natural explanation of the world we see.
But what about the why? I mean, here we are, we're doing this radio interview, we're talking about your wonderful work, the particle at the end of the universe. What are we all here for?
Well, it's a good question, and again, I think we should be open-minded. We may or may not be here for anything. My personal guess along these lines is that things like purpose and meaning, the reasons why, are things that we human beings come up with, not things that are given to us by the universe or from outside the universe. That it's our duty to assign and attribute meaningfulness and mattering to the events that occur around us. And I'm very comfortable with that. I think that's, it's a exciting, liberating, although occasionally scary way to think about the universe, but it seems to be what matches what we actually see.
Do other scientists feel about the same way?
It's not like an official stance or anything like that. I think that scientists tend to think along those lines when they do. There's plenty who don't. I have a good friend who is a theoretical cosmologist and also an evangelical Christian. And, he throws in jokes occasionally that, well, this equation must be right because I think God would have wanted it that way. And he's not serious. He's doing science exactly the same way that the rest of us are. He's trying to come up with the best equations that describe the data. But he truly in his heart believes that there is a purpose that comes from outside the universe. So you can do good science no matter what those beliefs are. But I think that more than the general audience, scientists tend to believe that ultimately we'll understand it all in terms of just the basic laws, the equations that govern how matter and energy behave.
When you were on, we were talking about From Here to Eternity some time ago. How does that differ from this writing, The Particle at the End of the Universe?
It's a little bit different, actually. From Eternity to Here was a lot about my own research, or at least the underlying ideas that drive my research and trying to understand the origin of the universe and the nature of time, how the past is different from the future. For The Particle at the End of the Universe, when I'm talking about the Higgs boson, it's related to what I do for a living, but it's not exactly the same. So in some sense, I was acting like an anthropologist, going in and figuring out how this tribe behaves and what it is they're doing. And I was impressed with experimental particle physics before I ever started, and I came away much more impressed than I even came into it with, because it's just such an incredible challenge to do what these people do. And as a result, I tried to write a book that not only explains the science, that's always the major goal, but also to convey some of the passion and excitement that the physicists themselves have. Why is it that they care about the Higgs boson of all things, right? It seems like a bizarre thing to care about. It's not going to lead to a cure for cancer or a better smartphone or anything like that. It's just figuring stuff out. And people have devoted their lives. And it's kind of it's an amazing little part of humanity that we have these people who think that there's nothing more important than finding a new particle of nature.
If there was one question that you would love to get the answer for, what would that be?
Well, I'm sure I will give you an answer, but first let me dodge a little bit. I'm sure that if I knew what physics was like 100 years from now, in the future, I would think that whatever question I'm going to want the answer to now would seem naive. Right?
Right, I would think so.
What we consider to be a good question changes as we know more and more things. But right now, the huge question in physics is how to reconcile gravity, Einstein's theory of general relativity, which describes the curvature of space and time, and that is what creates gravity, with quantum mechanics, the theory that we have of the subatomic world and the Higgs boson, for example. These two tremendously successful theories, general relativity and quantum mechanics, and without them, we can't explain the world. With them, we can, but they're mutually inconsistent with each other. So something's going to have to give, and a lot of brain power is being spent trying to reconcile that.
Would you say that everything that's out there in the universe just gelled perfectly? Even our solar system, where, we need the moon to survive. We need Jupiter where it is to block us, that it just all seems to work. How come?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And one of the, I think that rather than, I just talked about quantum gravity, but an equally good question could have been, how did life begin? What was the first?
Gosh, that was my next. That was my next one.
Ah, well, I don't have the answer to that one either. But I'm actually, since I wrote From Eternity to Here about entropy and the arrow of time, I've become more interested in the origin of life, because life is, in some sense, it seems odd from the point of view that entropy is increasing and the universe is just running down and becoming more tired and disorderly, right? But it turns out that when you look at it closely, you expect complicated structures to form as entropy increases. The temporary phenomenon, they will eventually go away, but complexity is a natural outgrowth of the increase of entropy in the universe. So in some sense, it's not surprising that life arose at all. It just happens all the time that some form of complex information processing structures would appear all by themselves. What we don't know is enough about the chemistry of the early Earth to say, does this happen 1% of the time, 1/1,000,000th of a percent of the time, or almost never, or almost always? Right now, the way that we are here on Earth, you're right, we need Jupiter and the moon or something like that. But if it weren't for Jupiter and the moon, maybe there'd be a completely different kind of life that would be very happy in that condition. That's what we don't know.
No, that's what we don't know at all. Interesting. Okay, well, the name of the book, The Particle at the End of the Universe. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more with you, Sean, about this, about the complexity in the universe as well. Plus, we'll take some phone calls. This is your opportunity to talk to a real theoretical physicist. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you love real science, you're getting that tonight as we talk with Dr. Sean Carroll, The Particle at the End of the Universe. We'll chat more with Sean, take your calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Sean Carroll, of course. We'll take some of your calls. Sean, when you were talking about what things could be like 100 years from now in terms of knowledge of physics, what gets us through that hurdle? From now to 100 years from now, how does that knowledge increase? What are the things that get us there?
It's interesting because it's a lot of little steps, but then suddenly some of those steps can become very big when there's a really important new insight or a really surprising experimental result. So we're sort of doing everything we can. We have some people looking way ahead, trying to come up with some grand unified theory of everything that we can possibly think of. And it involves a lot of speculation, a lot of guesswork, and a lot of courage to think that someday we'll know whether we're on the right track or not. But that's a very small minority of all the working physicists in the world. Most physicists work very close to the data with experiments, trying to understand how atoms and molecules and materials work, how the particles we've already detected fit together. And so we're just trying to learn everything we can about what we can get our hands on. And that pushes us forward bit by bit. And hopefully at some point it crystallizes. And then we go, ah, now I get something important and big that I didn't understand before.
It is amazing what happens out there. When you were a little boy, how did you get interested in all this? Because I'm sure that's how it starts.
It did. I was 10 years old, as I recall, when I first got interested in this kind of thing. And it was hanging out in my local public library, reading books in the whatever section of the Dewey Decimal System it was that was all the physics and astronomy books. And this was the mid-70s. And I was reading about general relativity, black holes, the Big Bang, particle physics, and it all seemed great. And I had no idea what it meant to be a theoretical physicist, but I figured out that's what I wanted to be, and here I am.
I might have been in that same library, Sean, looking at books on astral projection and reincarnation and ghosts. Isn't that amazing how that happens? I was 11. I mean, so it does affect us as youth.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you why I started reading those books. I mean, maybe somebody gave me one, maybe it was by accident. But, you know, I don't know what it's like to be 10 years old now. The public libraries are not as strong as they used to be. But on the other hand, you have the whole internet in front of you, and there's just so much stuff. So I think that it's really important that the experts in all fields make every effort to, you know, write books, write articles, write blogs, go on TV. One of the things I do here in L.A. is I consult as a scientist for movies and films, try to make the characters in science fiction movies a little bit more realistic, for example. And you never know when some character in some crazy movie is going to inspire some young kid to get interested in science.
How important has the computer been to our knowledgeable growth?
Well, it's been completely indispensable. You know, there's no possible way we could do what we do with the Large Hadron Collider without computers. As far as our knowledge of particle physics and astronomy is concerned, I can't even imagine what it would be like if we didn't have computers already. And contrary-wise, the attempts to get better and better at physics and astronomy have very often led the computer revolution. You know, trying to do better and better physics, the Manhattan Project was a big impetus for the very earliest computers. And these days, particle physics, gravitational wave astronomy, cosmology is leading and trying to figure out new ways to analyze huge data sets. So people like Google and Microsoft are very interested in astronomy because astronomers have these huge data sets and they give them away for free. And so we're learning new ways to analyze them that have very practical consequences.
Well, it is unbelievable what happens and the growth, the knowledge spurts and everything else. It's fantastic. Will we ever get to the point of, you know, teleportation, levitation, time travel? Will those things happen or are those just mysteries of the mind?
I think that the most interesting thing about technological advances is how unpredictable they are. You know, things like levitation or time travel are actually very easy to imagine, very difficult to do. But on the other hand, the internet is something that we didn't even imagine, right? You know, 50 years ago, maybe a couple of very visionary people did, but 100 years ago, nobody was imagining it. So what I predict is that 100 years from now, we will not have levitation and time travel, but we'll have something else absolutely amazing that we can't even think of right now.
Are our youth getting to the point where they will be able to replace these incredible minds that are getting old now?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, most progress in field like mine is driven by people under the age of 40, that's for sure. And I say this as someone who is over the age of 40, so I'm not biased in that way. You know, the older people in physics and math are experts at their fields. They're you know, repositories of wisdom. But you get comfortable doing a certain kind of thought process, a certain kind of physics or math or analysis. And it's the young people who come in who don't know what makes sense and what doesn't, and they splash around and come up with new techniques and new ideas that the older people wouldn't have ever stumbled on. So, you know, in the United States, we have a huge problem with our elementary school and high school science education. It's an embarrassment. It's much worse than elsewhere in the developing world. But our colleges and graduate schools are still the best in the world. So we still have that. We have a strong research program. People from other countries come here to study, and it's not the other way around. But that won't last forever unless we do a lot better educating our kids in science in an effective way.
All right, we're going to calls now. We're going to go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, wildcard line. Hey, Jerry, go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight?
Okay, Jerry, thank you.
Yeah, you guys are talking about, it's funny because you're kind of talking about, you know, advancement in technologies. I got a couple of things here, you know, after, you know, I was listening to you, one more thing came up. You know, we have this technology with the collider, but you're not asked, could this collider actually cause a black hole? Because when you mentioned that, it kind of like, that's kind of what I was thinking of when we were talking about the subject. And another thing is, without dark matter, wouldn't we just be floating in space, like, aimlessly? Without dark matter, so I don't think we have to look too far for dark matter. I wish we could use our technologies in a better way, because we have people starving. And, we don't always use our technologies in the nicest way. So if you could just say some positive things of what could be done with these things, that'd be nice. And I'll take my answer off there, and I really love your show, George.
Okay, Jerry. Well, we've talked about the possibility of the Hadron Collider, of creating little black holes. What's going on there, Sean?
Yeah, that was, it was an amusing diversion for a little while, but it was never a serious worry at all. The reality is that everything we do with the Large Hadron Collider is something that the universe is doing all the time out there in outer space. There are high-energy particles hitting our atmosphere all the time with much higher energies than we can make at particle accelerators here on Earth. So if there were little black holes or little particles that would have hurt us here on Earth, the universe would have done us in a long time ago. And it's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's the basic idea. So that was never really a worry. You know, the physicists don't want to destroy the world any more than anybody else does, and they studied this inside and out. You know, I do like the caller's question about what use we can put these technologies to, and I think that in some sense the world hasn't quite balanced itself in terms of applying the technology from the rich countries to the poor countries, or even from rich people in one country to everyone in that country. But better technology is going to be the key to making life better for everyone, you know, for making more clean water, more clean energy, more clean air. We have to use our technology wisely. That's up to us human beings. It doesn't happen automatically. But better technology is just going to make it easier, not harder.
I think so, too. Let's go to Toronto, Canada. Hey, Joe, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, Joey.
I'd like to ask the physicist, when we pass on, what happens to this energy or this soul matter? Does it just dissipate into space? Or is it possible that before you pass on, whoever you're thinking about at that time, this energy could be passed on to that individual? And also, I'd like to ask him about black holes. I believe in black holes. But if we're at a point where we can do something with black holes, how could we possibly utilize it without disappearing in another dimension and never coming back again?
That's a good one.
Good.
All right, first of all, let's talk about the energy dissipating when somebody dies. Where does it go?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So I can tell you my point of view, which is that you should think of a living being. What separates a live cat, let's say, from a dead cat? In physics, we like to use live and dead cats. Going back to Schrödinger, it's our favorite thought experiment. They look very different, right? The live cat is bouncing around, moving, and the dead cat is just sitting there. It looks very, very much like something has been lost. But the way that I like to think about it is that that what makes something alive rather than not alive is a process. It's not an energy. It's not like some force field, some energy of life, some vital force, as they used to think about it in the 19th century. It's just that there is a reaction, a process, a dynamics that is going on that comes to an end. Just like putting out a candle, the flame doesn't go anywhere. It just stops the oxidation. It stops the burning. It changes its chemical processes from one state to another. So I don't think that when you die, there's any place that your energy goes. I think that the motion of what makes you you changes into something else, something not alive anymore. That was one question. The other one is the black holes, right?
Black holes. So exactly what do you think they are?
Well, black holes are something that theoretically we understand quite well. And we see them, we see the evidence for them out there in space. We see things falling into what must be a black hole from everything that we can tell. But what you have to understand is that the crucial thing about a black hole is that they're very dense. They're very, you know, you can get very close to them. But they don't necessarily have to be very powerful. A tiny black hole has a very minuscule gravitational field. If you take a bowling ball and made it into a black hole, you could make it very, very, very small, but its gravitational field would still be that of a bowling ball, which is not that impressive. You don't notice the gravitational field of a bowling ball because gravity is a very weak force. So, you know, in order for something to be affecting us here on Earth, sucking us in or anything like that, you would need a black hole of astronomical magnitude, right? A star that has turned into a black hole or something like that. And those are pretty rare, and we would certainly know if something like that was in the vicinity.
Is there anything, Sean, that can go wrong with the universe that could affect us? Can we be gobbled up? Can something explode? I mean, is there anything out there?
Yeah, there's more than enough things out there that could go dramatically wrong.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, like and we have a good rule of thumb for thinking that it's unlikely, namely that life on Earth has persisted for almost 4 billion years, and it hasn't been wiped out. So there have been mass extinctions, but you know, life itself doesn't seem to have been disturbed by any cataclysmic event in the last 4 billion years, so it would be very, very unfortunate and unlikely indeed for it to be disturbed in the next 100 or 200 years, right? That would seem a little bit perverse, but still, we can imagine things from, you know, a nearby supernova explosion to, you know, some deep particle physics ideas where the very structure of space itself can alter, just like, you know, ice melting from solid into liquid or water boiling. The phase of space-time can dramatically change, which would instantly wipe out all of us here on Earth. Again, the math says the probability of this is really, really, really tiny. It's not something that is a practical worry. But if, you know, you have a bunch of theoretical physicists sitting around imagining ways that the Earth could be destroyed, they will have no problem coming up with all sorts of imaginative scenarios.
Michael in Tucson, Arizona, we'll get you in here. Michael, go ahead.
Hey, guys. George, hey, Mike. And Sean.
Hi.
What a great show. Oh, it's been very fertile with all the ideas and knowledge you have there.
Thank you.
It's very, very refreshing to know that some other people might be thinking of this kind of stuff. It drives me a little crazy sometimes trying to figure it all out. But
me too.
It drives me a lot crazy.
Yes. Like you said earlier, the universe.
We're losing you, Michael. We're losing you here. Let me see if I can put you on hold and see if we can get you back on. You in your better spot? No, he's gone. Okay, try to get back on, Michael. I would guess, and let me paraphrase what I think he was going to say with my intuitive mind, Sean.
Good.
You know, he was going to talk about the complexities of the universe and how we are, who we are. One of the questions we have been talking to you about, of course, is just who the heck are we? I mean, as human beings, you know, going through life, doing what we do, ups and downs and things like that. I mean, what's it all about?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. It's the right question to ask. And And my again, I can only give my personal answer. You know, I don't think that we human beings have completely figured this stuff out yet. So we're all groping in the dark a little bit here. But, you know, for me, I think it's to say what it's all about shouldn't imply that there is a secret out there to be found. It might just be that it is about what we make it about, that we care about each other as human beings, that we are not blank slates, that we have feelings, aspirations, desires, emotions, and goals, and we create the reason for us being here by being here ourselves. I think that's a very, very challenging but ultimately rewarding way of thinking about the purpose of us here in the universe.
Would you be in shock if you were convinced, if somebody convinced you, that there is a God out there?
I would be very surprised, but
you would.
But as a scientist, you know, you have to take what the data will tell you. Right now, I don't think the data is trending that way, but if the situation changes, you have to change your mind.
Next up, Ray in Boise, Idaho. Go ahead, Ray. Thanks. You're on Coast to Coast.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have a hypothetical question.
All right. Mm-hmm.
You still there?
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I have a hypothetical question, and it involves the 14 point whatever billion light years we are from the beginning of the universe.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, let's assume that you and I are in this telescope, and it's pointed up at 45 degrees. And it's pointed to where they believe the beginning of the universe is, right?
Okay.
And it's, say, it's facing south, okay? Well, now, let's take, and so that's 14, say, 6 billion years. Let's say we rotate that 180 degrees to the north, and then we depress the telescope 45 degrees, or directly opposite from what we had been looking at. I know it can't be done. But let's just make believe it can be, and then we remove the Earth from our position. What is out there?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. The answer is that there is no place where the universe began. According to the best theories we have right now, which seem to fit the data very well, the universe began everywhere at once, at the same time. So that theory predicts that if you look back in time in your telescope in one direction of the sky, you should see basically the same thing as you would see if you pointed it in the opposite direction of the sky. And in fact, that is exactly what we see in our telescopes. We see the leftover radiation from the earliest moments of the universe's history, the hot Big Bang. And it was very hot, and it was radiating to beat the band, and there's a lot of light, and it's cooled off since then because the universe has expanded and cooled. And we look back there and we see that light. It's the microwave background radiation, and it's the same in all directions when we look at the sky.
It's going to come back. We're going to take some more phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll take more of your phone calls with Sean Carroll. Hey, by the way, do you like to sound off every Wednesday? A Coast to Coast listener gets to sound off. You can too. Send your editorial and your phone number to editorial at coasttocoastam.com, and Tom will go through that. He might give you a call, record you, and then we'll play it on a Wednesday. Editorial at coasttocoastam.com. Sean Carroll, what is the universe? What do you think it is?
Well, the universe is everything that there is. What people like me try to do is to find out what is the best description of the universe that we can come up with. But the universe is what's out there. Whatever it doesn't, a lot of it is what we see, but there's a lot of it beyond what we see. And we're trying to come up with the best model that fits everything at once.
You know, I have a difficult time trying to comprehend, you know, the Big Bang and evolving from nothingness. You know, the talk is that maybe it came from another universe. And of course, we've been talking for years now about multiverses as well, that they could be all over the place. Bubbles stuck together, but I do have a difficult time trying to comprehend what came before something. How do you answer that?
Well, I think that we have no right to think that we know. I think that it's both, that's well beyond what our experiments have taught us anything about, or our theories are able to believably describe. So we should be open-minded. So it is possible that time itself didn't exist before the Big Bang. And Stephen Hawking famously said, it's like asking, what is north of the North Pole? There is just no such thing. The concept itself doesn't make sense. What is before the Big Bang? But it's also possible that the Big Bang is just like a moment that we can't see past. It's opaque to us because it was so violent and dense and hot and bright that it is something that we can't peer before using the telescopes that we currently have. So I think that, you know, we can be curious about it. That's fine. But we can't imagine that that's something we have the answer to just yet.
Okay, let's go next to Alhambra, California. John's turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, John, go ahead.
Hey, thank you. I'm interested in the confidence that the physicist has in the dark matter. It seems to me that Newtonian physics was a pretty good theory, and that in part it proved inadequate when applied to different scales, extreme scales, like very small quantum mechanics took over, high speeds, relativity was better, and that it seems to me dark matter, there could either be dark matter really, or it could be that the standard model now is inadequate at the scales that we look for dark matter. And I was wondering what tipped the physicists one way or the other, because it seems like to me that it could be one or the other.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair set of questions, and plenty of people, including me, have made proposals for could we escape the conclusion of dark matter by imagining that what's really going on is that we don't understand gravity, for example. But what has tipped the scales is the fact that these days we have such precise observations that it's not only we're detecting more gravity than we thought. That was, you know, the original impetus for believing in dark matter was that the total amount of gravity coming out of a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies was bigger than you would expect. So we say, well, there's more stuff there than we thought, so it's dark matter. But these days, we know more than that. It's not just that there's stronger gravity. It's that there's gravitational fields even where there's no matter. There's no visible matter. There's no matter we can see. And yet there's still gravity pulling things in the direction of what? Of nothing that we can obviously see. Now, it's exactly what you would expect if there were dark matter. Then, you know, there's the dark matter is there. It's causing a gravitational field. It makes perfect sense to us. It's very hard to imagine explaining that by just modifying the force of gravity. And, you know, beyond that, we go into the numbers. You know, we make very, very specific predictions based on this idea of dark matter, and they keep coming true, these predictions. Predictions for how that relic radiation from the Big Bang looks like, for example. So either it's dark matter or the universe is jumping through a huge number of hoops and bending over backwards to look exactly like it's dark matter, even though there's not.
Okay, let us go next to Oakland, California. Hello, Robin. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you very much, George. I want you to know that I think that there's going to be a Nobel Prize in your future.
In George's future?
Not in my future.
Oh, indeed. I think that's true. Don't you, Doctor?
I cannot possibly deny that, no.
Okay.
Thank you.
I have one question, and I have one postulation. My question is, I'm dragging way behind. I left off with wave physics. You know, we went down to the atom and below and below and below, and then we hit the wave, and everything was wave. And so perhaps you could address that. And the other postulation is, anybody who has had an out-of-body experience or an after-death experience, Danny and Brinkley would, I'd love to hear the two of you together, but, you know, you don't need a brain. Actually, I don't think you can comprehend God with a physical brain, and that simply because you put the light out on the candle does not make it, the light doesn't disappear when you're working with consciousness. And so I'll take my answer on the air.
Yes, you will.
Well, I think that I can answer something sensible about the first question there, because you're very much on the right track. You've heard a lot of talk about waves, and sometimes some people have heard about this apparent question, is light, for example, a particle or a wave? Is it like the electromagnetic wave that we talked about, or is it a photon, a particle of light? And in some sense, the answer is it's both. It depends on the circumstance. But when you get down to it, if you insist that it's one or the other, it's waves. And that's true not only for light, that's also true for matter itself, for the atoms that you're made of, the protons, the neutrons, the electrons that make up your atoms and your chemistry. These are all waves. And in fact, there are little bundles of energy vibrating in these waves. And this subject is called quantum field theory. It's how all modern physicists think about the world. It's not something we talk about a lot in popularizations. You know, we talk a lot about particle physics and relativity and quantum mechanics, but we don't talk about quantum field theory, the idea that the world is really made of waves at the deep down level. So all this is to say that I try to do this in the new book. I really try to take the idea of fields and waves seriously. I'm doing my best here to give you the straight dope about how we think about what the fundamental ingredients of nature really are.
You had an opportunity to interview so many key players connected to CERN. Is there any one person out there, Sean, that just, in your opinion, is just the tops?
Well, there's... CERN is a huge place, and I only with great trepidation would I even start mentioning individual names, because every time you mention one, there's 1,000 other people who are being left out. But let me mention one name, which is Lynn Evans, who is a Welsh physicist, who's an experimental physicist, not a theoretical physicist, but he was the guy who was basically the boss of the project of building the Large Hadron Collider from the start to the finish. And he saw it through, you know, and it involves everything from designing detectors and tubes to coaxing presidents and prime ministers to give up the money. And so it's a lot of practical knowledge, a lot of physics knowledge. You know, one story I like to tell is that they were digging a hole in the ground to send one of the experiments down to the pipes where the LHC is, and it's in France. And they hit a Roman ruin when they started digging. So they had to stop all the excavation while they went in and very, very carefully picked out all of the Roman ruins for the archaeologists. And they started again, and they hit an underground river, which they hadn't known about. So they actually put down pipes of liquid nitrogen to freeze the water in the river so they could dig it out and then keep digging. And all these are things that, you know, getting a PhD in physics does not prepare you to deal with this kind of stuff. So Lynn Evans was the boss of the project, and he saw it through in an incredible way. So I give him a lot of credit for the success we're seeing right now in the Large Hadron Collider.
Jimmy in Galveston, Texas, we'll get you in here. Jimmy, go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you.
Sure, Jim.
Speaking of money, I would like to hear how your guests can justify the expense of CERN, considering the financial crisis of all the countries that are involved in that project. And if it has to do with the Higgs particle and how that might generate new technology, how exactly is that related to creating new technology that's going to help us all out?
Fair questions. Fair questions, Sean.
Yeah, I think it's a very fair question, and you know, it on the one hand, it sounds like a tremendous amount of money. $9 billion is big change. I don't want to downplay that, but that's spread out over almost 20 years of effort, and it's spread out, as we said, over 100 countries. When you compare this amount of money being spent on particle physics to the amount of money that many, many governments spend on many, many other things, you know, it's nothing. It's a drop in the bucket compared to a lot of things that we're spending money on. The space station is 10 times as much as the Large Hadron Collider, easily. And, you know, it's given us something that, to me and to many other people, is incredibly precious, a view into a part of reality that we could not get any other way. And to me, that alone makes it worth the money. And fortunately, to enough taxpayers throughout the world, that is also true. But it's furthermore true that whenever we spend money on physics, the economy ultimately benefits more than the money we put in. Because physicists are smart people, they're pushing the boundaries of the envelope of technology and what's possible. And they say they're looking for the Higgs boson, but they come back and they say, oh, you know, we've invented a brand new way to do superconductivity. Or, look, we've invented the fastest way of transmitting information across cables across the ocean and things like this. That's a little spin-off, an unanticipated side effect. So to me, it's kind of a no-brainer. You spend money on a well-motivated physics project, and you both discover something great about the universe and get all these unanticipated technological benefits.
All right, it's Goldsboro, North Carolina now. Jeff's with us. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Sean. This is Jeff from Goldsboro, North Carolina. If you want a good series about time, get Sean Carroll's DVD from the Teaching Company, George. I think you'd enjoy that.
I did not pay him to say that, by the way.
You didn't have to. It's good.
Yeah, it's good. My question, Sean, is from your book, From Eternity to Here. Victor Stenger has come up with a model that's very similar to yours in his book Timeless Symmetry, and he says that the entropy state of the early universe can be both high and low. He says our universe was once in a state of complete chaos in which local order did not form until it started to expand. The entropy was maximal at that early time. It was also small and could increase as the maximum allowable entropy increased with the universe expansion. And in your book, you say something very similar. You say the moment of lowest entropy is not actually a moment of low entropy. That middle moment was not finely tuned to some very special low entropy initial condition. It was as high as we could get. So could you explain that a little bit more? I think I understand it. I think it's high from a multiverse perspective, but low from our particular universe perspective. And how does your model, how is it similar to Victor Stenger's model?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that they're a little bit different because we're using different definitions of what we mean by entropy. I have a model, just so that everyone knows what we're talking about. I have a model where the universe we see is a tiny little part of a much, much bigger multiverse. And the reason why we see the universe we do is because the multiverse is restless. It never stands still. It's trying to grow and create more entropy and more disorderliness all the time. And the way it does this is by creating new universes like ours, which add to the confusion of the universe. And it's what I'm trying to do is to create a model in which there was never a special point of really, really high orderliness and a delicate arrangement of stuff. Everything could just be randomly scattered throughout the universe at all times. So Victor Stenger's model is a little bit different, and I think that he's just defining entropy a little bit differently than I am. But we're both reaching to understand the same thing, which is why the actual early universe we observe looks so special to us.
Okay, very well said, by the way. So the book, The Particle at the End of the Universe, where do you get it?
You get it wherever fine books are sold, Amazon.com. Any good bookstore should have it now. It literally just came out today, so they make great holiday presents.
And you've written other books as well, of course, Space, Time, and Geometry. Of all this that you do, what fascinates you the most of your work?
Well, you know, right at this minute, the research problem that I'm working on is actually about the foundations of quantum mechanics. You know, quantum mechanics is this wonderful theory that is the best physical theory we have and have had since the 1920s and 30s. But, embarrassingly enough, we all admit that we don't quite understand it. It's very different than general relativity or electromagnetism or other theories we have where we know what we're talking about. When it comes to quantum mechanics, there are deep mysteries there. And so I think that I'm trying to make progress in unraveling some of those deep mysteries. And the idea, it seems very pretentious to me, even though I'm the one who's doing it. The idea that I'm going to sit here, think hard, and then come back and tell you, oh, here's how to make sense of quantum mechanics, and then they will pay me to do it, will never cease to amaze me.
No, never at all. Well, a good job. Who came up with the cover? Good idea.
Well, it's that the cover of my new book is actually sort of a reflection of the cover of my old book. In the old book, in From Eternity to Here, there was matter falling into a black hole, and in the new book, there is a view down the beam pipe of the LHC that almost looks like you're falling into a black hole.
They had problems for a while, didn't they, trying to get that thing up and running?
They did. You know, they started on in September 2008, and 10 days later, there was an incident, an accident where one of the magnets warmed up too much and spilled helium all over the place, which is too bad.
And didn't a bird fly over it and drop some bread or something?
Well, that was more a fun story than an actual setback. That was there was a story where a bird dropped a little piece of bread onto an electrical power station and shorted something out. This is, you know, the kind of thing, it's like a circuit breaker going off in your house. It's an annoyance for 5 minutes, and then you fix it. But because it was in the aftermath of this much more serious problem, people were getting a little frazzled at the time. But they fixed that, they set it right back up again, and ever since then, it's been running like a charm.
Hey, but that did happen, didn't it?
It absolutely did happen, and I even talk about it in the book. Yeah, I tell all the inside scoop there.
What would you like people to take away from the particle at the end of the universe? What piece of knowledge would you like them to have?
I think that, you know, as we've been discussing a bit here, you know, it's a really good and solid question. Why should we care about the Higgs boson of all things? So I want people to both understand what the Higgs boson does, you know, what purpose it serves to the physicists, but also why there is so much passion and devotion and energy put into this seemingly esoteric pursuit of understanding the laws of physics at a deep level. It's not because there are immediate practical consequences or because we'll travel faster than the speed of light. It's just because we want to figure things out. And I remember when I was 10 years old and learning about physics, reading books in the library, and I caught that excitement. If I can share some of that excitement with everybody else, then it'll be a success.
I think so, too. Are your views similar to Stephen Hawking or different?
In a lot of ways, they are. I mean, Hawking is a brilliant guy, and he likes to be iconoclastic. He lost a bet when the Higgs boson was discovered. He placed a bet that we wouldn't find the Higgs boson.
That's right.
So
I remember
he was happy
that.
To pay up.
We're coming back for final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to another hour of Coast to Coast AM, where we're talking real science, the particle at the end of the universe. Dr. Sean Carroll, our guest. And your phone calls all next on Coast to Coast AM. Sean, do you believe the universe has order to it?
Yeah, I think that there is order. There's certainly, for example, a continuity from moment to moment with the same kinds of particles, roughly speaking, obeying what we think are the laws of physics.
How did it get there? How did the law of physics get applied?
I don't know. It might just be that that's just the way it is, that what we call a law uses the word in English that is the same as we use when there's a legislature that passes a regulation. But the universe doesn't have a legislature like that. This is just a sloppy use of the English language. It could just be there. There could be a deeper reason for it. We should be open-minded about that.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Laura in Philadelphia. Hi, Laura. Thanks for holding so long. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Good morning, and good morning, Sean. George, if I just may say to you very quickly, when I discovered Coast to Coast about 6 years ago, the first show, you were talking about shadow people, and I said to myself, I'm not listening ever again. But lo and behold, I hung on for this many years, and I have to tell you, I think you are a man for all seasons, you are a renaissance man, and you deserve all the kudos that you get.
Well, thank you, Laura.
Having said that, Sean, I'd like to use a typical Twilight Zone episode to present my question. The astronaut goes into space, travels a certain amount of time at a certain speed. He's 30 years old. He leaves a 30-year-old wife behind, and he comes back X amount of time later, and she's 80 years old. Given that we have charted the speed of light, we have charted the speed of sound, how are we so sure, in relation to that example that I just gave you, that we know the speed of time, given that we ourselves have charted the speed of time, if my question makes any sense to you. And this is a sort of little itch that's been bothering me ever since I saw a Twilight Zone episode like that.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing to talk about. I do talk about this a lot in my previous book, From Eternity to Here, which is about how time works. And it's actually something we understand a lot about. This Twilight Zone episode uses the idea from relativity that if one person stays stationary here on Earth and someone else zips out at the speed of light and then zips back, the person who went on the trip will have experienced much less time than the person who stayed back here on Earth. And that's not restricted to the Twilight Zone or to TV. That's something we know is true based on experiments here on Earth. We send particles, not human beings, but individual particles very, very close to the speed of light. And, for example, we send particles that can decay, that have a lifetime. You know, they last for about 1 second before they decay. And we zoom them to the speed of light, or very, very close to it, and suddenly they last for a lot longer than 1 second, because their experience of time is different than ours. And that's something we utterly understand. That was also the subject of my technical book, Space, Time, and Geometry, How Relativity Teaches Us About This. So time is something whose behavior is something that, you know, in the everyday world or the world of rocket ships and experiments here on Earth, we have a theory that fits the data very, very well. It's counterintuitive, it surprises us, but it is within the realm of our understanding.
Thank you very much. I think I'll stay away from the Twilight Zone episode. Thank you very much, Joe.
Thanks,
good Laura. Morning.
Okay, I appreciate that. You have fun doing this, Sean, I can tell.
Absolutely. What could be more fun than figuring out how the world works?
Tell me about the students over the years. What are they looking for? What do they want to learn?
You know, in the particular field I'm in, almost inevitably, the students are kind of idealistic, right? They're not in it for the money. There's a lot of ways to make a lot more fame or glory or money for a smart person than studying theoretical physics, let's put it that way. They want to know the answers. They're driven to do the hard work of learning these difficult theories, mastering what has come before them, and trying to contribute a little bit in their own way to moving past that. They're all different. This is a great thing about science, is that there's no right technique for doing it. People have their own individual styles, and you never know what's going to pay off. And they're just relentlessly curious, which is what drove them here in the first place. And it's always a pleasure to be challenged by the students who are coming up young and hungry behind you.
So you're bullish on the future here?
Very much, yeah. No, I mean, there's just so many talented, bright people working hard, figuring things out. The data is coming in. We live in a really good time to be thinking about how the universe works.
Let's go next to Griffin in Pasco, Washington. Griffin, go ahead.
I've got a couple of quick questions for you guys this morning, the first of which stems from a book that I read by Michio Kaku a ways back, and he dipped on the idea of how our three physical dimensions move and interact inside of the fourth, fifth, and sixth, and so on. And I'm having a lot of trouble visualizing that as far as how our physical matter or waves or, you know, particles react to another physical dimension around and through us. Also, the idea of gravity, I know, I mean, as a weak force and as much as anybody else does, but when it's described as, or the way that it was described to me is as like the fifth dimension sort of folding in upon itself to create force in between, you know, atoms of different masses. Just wondering if you could paint a little bit of a clearer picture for me, and I'll take my answers off the air.
All right. Thanks, Griffin. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that that last bit it does not sound quite right to me. Gravity, as we currently understand it from Einstein, is the curvature of space-time itself. And mathematically, we have no trouble describing that. You know, once you go through years of education in mathematics, then you have no trouble describing it. We know what to do. But picturing it is very hard. As you walk through a room, you don't think of the space around you as something that has curvature or a geometry. It's just a little bit of an alien concept. So we draw pictures, right? Or we make visual representations to try to get across what's going on. And inevitably, we draw or represent curved two-dimensional surfaces embedded in this three-dimensional space that's around us. So people get the idea that space is sort of curling into a new dimension that we don't see, but that's misleading. That's just an artifact of our attempts to make it more visual. The reality is that as far as we know, from experience, from experiment, from observation, there are three dimensions of space, one dimension of time, and that's all you need. Now, there are theories that are very popular and promising theories that say that there are additional dimensions, but they're very, very small. They're curled up into a tiny little ball so that we can't see them. And the way in which those dimensions are curled up and hidden can affect the particle physics we know and love, the mass and the charge and the interactions of different kinds of particles. That's a speculative but very interesting and promising idea, but it's not something that's established right now.
All right, thank you for that. Gabriel in Orlando, Florida. He's been on hold for a while. Hi, Gabe. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. It's a fascinating show tonight.
Thank you.
My question is, I was very curious about how the Large Hadron Collider would have compared to the canceled superconducting supercollider, and I'd like to know what you think the future of experimental physics will be in this country. Will we have any more mega-scale projects like the canceled SSC, or is this strictly going to be results of international collaboration due to the incredible expense required for these projects?
Yeah, these are fantastic questions that go right to the heart of the future of particle physics. Here in the United States, we had a project, the superconducting supercollider. It started in the 1980s, and it was killed in the 1990s by Congress about the same time as the Large Hadron Collider in Europe really got going. And the U.S. project would have been bigger and better. It was more expensive. It was higher energy. It was a very impressive machine. And eventually we decided we couldn't afford it. So we, you know, sold it off, and now it's sort of lying there in Texas as a big empty hole. What's going to happen in the future? It's very hard to tell. I would be very surprised if any one country decided that they just were going to do it themselves in terms of the next big particle accelerator. It's just something that seems too big a task in the modern world for any one country to do. Now, the Japanese are very interested in the possibility of hosting a collider because they're trying to recover from the tsunami that they suffered not too long ago, and it's a good way to sort of move forward in reconstructing your infrastructure to have a big project like that. But they would need a lot of help from other countries in the world if they were to do it at all. And there's still the possibility that nobody will do it. You know, it's expensive. There are other interests, other concerns that people in the world have. Budgets are tight. So in the sad future scenario, the Large Hadron Collider is the last major particle accelerator ever built. I really hope that that's not the case, but it's a real possibility that we need to consider.
I think so, too. Toronto, Canada, Chris, your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi there. I'm glad you're getting into relativity now. I have a couple of questions for you. Just two things. The first being, I look online and I find a couple of engines that look like they could actually make gravity as an engine, and some of them make sense. I wanted to ask you about this one. You know how the faster you go, the more energy you have to expend because you become more massive, so you don't reach the speed of light?
Yes.
What if you put a ferrofluid in a torus and wrap a coil around that? The electricity would spin it around, and with an additional apparatus using a same side-facing magnets and circles, you could give it additional speed. You could control how fast it goes and thus how heavy it gets, I guess. You can make gravity, right?
Well, that's right. Einstein taught us, among many things that Einstein taught us, E equals mc squared. So what that means is that if you have an object at rest, its mass is basically equal to the amount of energy it has. Its mass times the speed of light squared. So if you take an object and you put more energy in it by heating it up, by spinning it, by putting electrical fields in there, or various ways of putting more energy in, it will weigh more. It will have more mass, and therefore will create more gravity. Now, if you actually take the numbers seriously, this is a horrifically inefficient way of making gravity. You have to get that energy from somewhere, and the amount of energy you need to make even a little bit of mass is a tremendous amount, because if E equals mc squared, then m is E divided by c squared. So to get any mass at all, you need a huge amount of energy, since the speed of light is such a big number. So I don't think it's a practical consideration, to be honest. I think that it's something you can imagine doing, but if you want gravity, just get a big hunk of stuff, and that'll give you gravity.
How close is Hollywood to real-life physics when they come out with their movies and, you know, their warp speed shows and things like that?
Well, it depends a lot, actually, on the specifics. You know, Hollywood is not in the business of science education. That's not why they're there. They're in the business of selling tickets and entertaining you. So sometimes the way to do that is to throw the laws of physics away. And, you know, just the idea of traveling faster than the speed of light violates the laws of physics, but much of science fiction would be possible without it. Then in other circumstances, you want a movie or a TV show that is as realistic as you can get it, because it adds to the verisimilitude. And there they try to do a relatively good job. And believe it or not, The Big Bang Theory, the sitcom that is one of the highest-rated TV shows on television, gets the science completely correct. They have a paid science advisor who is a professor of physics at UCLA, and every little equation that you see on the whiteboards and every little bit of technobabble they're trading back and forth,
it's
that is vetted
real
for scientific accuracy.
Sure is. Let's go next to Vince in Cupertino, California. Hey, Vince, go ahead.
Hey, guys. Great show tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
My question is, you know, as far as how accepted something like a theory of evolution is to describe, you know, in this society, where does string theory and M theory fit as far as a description of the universe and the leading theories? And if they're not, where does the data point to as far as a theory that is considered kind of the evolution of acceptedness of, you know, the laws of physics in the universe?
And explain string theory again for us.
Right, in 2 seconds, yes. String theory is actually easy to explain. It's the idea that what you think of as particles, electrons, quarks, neutrinos, whatever, are really little loops or segments of vibrating string. And if you ask string of what, you're not allowed to ask that. It's the stuff that strings are made out of. That's the fundamental stuff of reality. And all the particles we see are different ways that these strings can move and vibrate. And this simple-sounding idea, so you take that idea, you write down some equations to try to describe how the strings vibrate, and you get out a tremendous amount, including a prediction that there should be something called gravity. Now, unfortunately for string theory, this prediction was made long after gravity was discovered, so it doesn't really count as a brand new prediction. But it's very encouraging that we have a theory that automatically gives you gravity whether you like it or not, because we know that there is gravity in the world. Now, to the caller's question, though, there is no data that indicate that string theory is on the right track, other than the fact that there is gravity and there are other ways in which the world looks very compatible with string theory, but these were all ways that were already there before we invented string theory. So the fair analysis of the situation is that right now string theory is certainly the most promising way we have of trying to get at that question I mentioned earlier of reconciling quantum mechanics and gravity, unifying quantum gravity in a single theory. String theory is a leading candidate, but it has not yet succeeded in making predictions for the real world that we can go out there and measure and then figure out whether it's right or not. So that doesn't mean that it's right or wrong. It means that it's nowhere near the status of something like natural selection, Darwinian evolution, where we have predictions that have come true. We have plenty of data that shows that it's there. Right now, string theory is still very much a speculation.
Peter Higgs, who is he? They named the particle after him.
They did, and that's a source of controversy, the fact that they named the particle after him, because, in fact, there's at least seven different physicists who wrote papers in 1963 and 64 suggesting very similar ideas to each other, and Higgs was one of them. But he wasn't the first or the last. He was the first to specifically mention that there would be a new particle that this idea predicts. Remember that the important thing about the Higgs idea is this field that spreads throughout the universe, and that was the idea that all these different physicists were talking about. But there's Philip Anderson, Robert Brout, Francois Englert, there's people named Guralnik, Hagen, and Kibble. They all came up with this idea. Higgs himself is 83 years old now. He has worked in Edinburgh in Scotland for most of his professional career. He's a very unassuming, nice man. You know, he is very, very pleased that the idea that he helped pioneer has become such a big deal. It's very likely that somebody is going to win a Nobel Prize for this idea very soon, but we don't know who, because the Nobel Prize, as a tradition, only three or fewer people can win it in any one year. And in that case, it's very unclear who it might go to.
Sean, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Gary David joins us. We're going to be talking about artifacts, Hopi prophecy. Make sure you're part of that show. When we come back in just a moment with Sean Carroll, The Particle at the End of the Universe, let's take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. More calls here for Sean Carroll, The Particle at the End of the Universe. How long will they run, CERN? Sean, how long will the Large Hadron Collider go?
It depends, but quite a while. In fact, they're going to shut down early next year to sort of take the machine apart and upgrade it, and then start again in 2015 with a much higher energy. And then they'll probably go for 20 years at least, and depending on, you know, how the funding and situation goes and so forth, they might upgrade it once again sometime down the road.
Some people think there's some kind of secret government project going on down there.
Yeah, you know, we have enough, and our hands are full doing particle physics. I think that if you were going to have a secret government project, you would put it very far away from a bunch of scientists with not a lot of respect for authority. Let's put it that way.
They're trying to drill down to the core, aren't they, to keep it from stopping or something?
Well, they got 300 feet down, so they're pretty far away from the core.
Mike is in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Hey, George. I got to tell you, this is a terrific show for a retired baby boomer physics teacher.
Oh, my gosh. Perfect.
Of course, my interest did not end with my retirement. In fact, I think I'm into it more than ever before now.
It became your hobby.
Exactly. My question for Sean is a little unusual, probably, because it mixes physics with medicine. However, I'm interested to know that if he thinks that this research could lead to even smaller nanoparticles that could attack not only cancer cells, but also the very, very tiniest invaders we have, the viruses. If that could be, you know, this research could lead. It's fascinating stuff. I'm just wondering if he thinks this research could lead to some type of implications in medicine. And I'll sign off and take my answer off the air.
Okay, Mike, thank you. What do you think of that, Sean?
Well, it's interesting. There certainly have been applications of particle accelerator technology to medicine. I don't think that the Higgs boson research in particular is going to be relevant to medicine because it's at such high energies. I mean, you need a 17-mile-long particle accelerator to achieve what we're doing here, and that's just not a feasible medical strategy. You can do things much easier with much smaller devices. So I think the general field of particle physics has been very helpful to medicine, including if you want to go way back in discovering things like X-rays. But I don't think that the Large Hadron Collider research in particular is going to do that. I could be surprised, but that's not my guess.
Sir Isaac Newton, are his theories still strong today?
Well, they're good enough to, for instance, fly to the moon, which is pretty good. You don't need to know general relativity to get a rocket from here to the moon or back. So I think that what Newton did was get something right, but we now have instruments, have observations that are so precise, we can detect effects that are so subtle that Newton didn't know about them. And so therefore we need a better theory than Newton came up with, and Einstein gave us that theory. So Newton is still, in my mind, the greatest physicist of all time. We now know that his theories have been superseded, but they're still very accurate in the regime where we apply them. To play baseball, you don't need to know quantum mechanics or relativity. You just need to know Newtonian physics.
James in Asheville, North Carolina. James, go ahead.
Hi, excellent show. I'm just going to throw out a couple of questions for you.
Sure.
A few months ago, there was a story that came out over the news media from Switzerland that they had broken the light barrier. And then they didn't. Was there an instrument malfunction? The story went away real quick.
Yes.
But I want your comment on that. Also, you talk about dark matter. You know, we know it's there. We can't prove it, but we know it's there. Antimatter is not science fiction. We know it's there. From what I understand, it's very difficult to produce, but do you consider there to be a possibility of an energy source there?
Yeah, these are both very good questions. There was a news story in 2011, last year, where scientists starting at CERN, the same place where the Large Hadron Collider is located, they made neutrinos, and they shot them underneath the Earth to a laboratory in Italy where they were detected. And the result was that it seemed that the neutrinos were traveling faster than the speed of light. And roughly speaking, nobody believed them because this
exactly.
is a very difficult measurement to do, and it would truly overthrow a lot of how we think about particle physics if that were right. And it would have been very fun. It would have been great if it were true. So we wanted to believe it, but we were skeptical, and eventually they figured out that indeed there was a loose cable, basically, and their timing apparatus was miscalibrated, and they were just wrong. So that went away.
It's too bad.
Nothing left about that, yeah. And, sorry, what was the other one?
Antimatter.
Yeah, antimatter we make all the time. It's very easy to make, but it's not a great energy source because it requires a lot of energy to make it. If you want a good energy source, you want energy that's already out there that you can collect. If we had better technology, antimatter might make a good energy storage device. If you collect energy from the sun, for example, use it to make antimatter and then carry that antimatter around with you so you can later release the energy contained in it. But that's right now a science fiction scenario. We don't nearly have good enough technology to pull that off.
Sean, do you think if we went into a black hole, we'd be torn to bits?
I'm pretty sure that if we went into a black hole, we'd be torn to bits. I'm not completely sure because nobody's ever done it, and if anyone ever did do it, they wouldn't be able to report back. But our best theories right now certainly say that that is true, so I don't think anyone's going to be volunteering anytime soon.
I wonder if we could send a probe into a wormhole. Is there one close enough to do that?
Actually, wormholes, as far as we know, don't exist. A black hole is a firm prediction of general relativity. It's what happens when a star collapses and the gravitational field is so strong that nothing can escape. And that's something we see in the sky. We see examples of what really look like black holes. The center of our galaxy has a black hole about 4 million times the mass of the sun. But a wormhole is something where you would go in and then be spat out somewhere else in the universe. And theorists like me can write down scenarios about what that would be like, but there's no evidence at all that they really exist in nature.
Vancouver, Washington, Ryan, west of the Rockies.
Yeah,
Ryan.
I was just wondering if you could cook antimatter for Thanksgiving. I'm just joking. No, I'll keep this brief. I just heard the last half an hour of the show. What's the difference between quantum physics and particle physics? I never quite understood that because my brain works so fast, but I'll take the answer off the air. You guys have a good night, okay?
Okay, Ryan, thank you for calling. Go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Particle physics is basically an application of quantum mechanics or quantum physics. Quantum mechanics is a way of thinking. It's what has replaced classical mechanics. Classical mechanics was Isaac Newton's great gift to the world, the idea that, you know, every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, for example. That's an example of classical mechanics. And then quantum mechanics comes along in the early 20th century and says, you know, there's not even such a thing as positions and velocities. There are wave functions that tell you the probability of getting different answers. And that's a very general way of thinking about how the world works. And particle physics is what you get when you apply that idea of quantum mechanics, put it in the context of relativity, which Einstein gave us, and you invent quantum field theory, which we talked about at the very beginning of the show. And when you look at the fields, like the electromagnetic field, you see particles. You see photons when you look at the electromagnetic field, gravitons when you look at the gravitational field. So particle physics is relativity plus quantum mechanics.
All right, a few more calls here. Let's go to Don in Ohio. Hey, Don, thanks for calling. Go ahead. You with us?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Donnie.
I was just wondering, there was some tests back in the early 60s, late 50s, I guess, at Stanford in that accelerator called a gold foil test. And it led to some breakthroughs because of ionization. It led to some breakthroughs in physics that they was able to develop a lot of the space stuff with, the space rockets, and they went to the moon on. And I was just wondering, is any of his research right now dealing with any of that?
Sean?
Not really, to be honest. Laboratories in physics have interesting life cycles. You know, they're planned for a purpose, and then 20 years later, that purpose is fulfilled, and they do something else. For example, the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, SLAC, as it's known, was a particle accelerator. It won multiple Nobel Prizes for the work that was done there, and now it's done. So they turned off the particle accelerator, and they now use it as to make high-intensity X-rays, and which are used to study chemistry and biology. So my work is mostly concerned with high-energy particle physics and cosmology. So the frontiers there now are at CERN, at the Large Hadron Collider, and also at various telescopes and satellites around the world that are telling us more about the universe.
Next up, Toronto, Canada. Fausto, it's your turn. Hi, Fausto.
Hi, George Norrie. I'm a longtime listener from 1999, listening to you live on AM 640 and 510 CKTV.
Super. Thank you.
Now, Mr. Master Physicist, I would like to know your future forecast with respect to the water contamination that continues to be polluted and poisoned, landing on the west coast of North America, I guess around Cali, between Cali and Japan. What say you with regards to fish, water, eating any fish? What's going to happen to the east coast? Anything in between time and in between time?
Whew. Yeah, I think these are great questions, which you should not ask me about, to be honest. I mean,
physicist might not have that answer, right?
You could ask random people on the street and get just as much educated responses as you could me. I'm very much aware of and concerned about the damage we are doing to the Earth, the atmosphere, the oceans, et cetera. It's very real, and I know the experts are very concerned, and I think we should listen to them.
Is there any downside of physics here, Sean? Can anything go happen? Not in the universe, as I asked you last time, but can anything happen on this planet because of physics, because they tinker around too much?
Because physics works with nature at a very fundamental level, and because physics was deeply involved with nuclear power and the atomic bomb and so forth, physicists have become incredibly good at being careful. Every time there's a new particle accelerator or a new experiment or something like that, there are multiple studies done about how safe it is and, whether it's a good idea and so forth. And you're never perfect. Of course, there can always be accidents, but these days, the accidents, the really bad things, are much more likely to come from biology, medicine, pathology, than they are from physics.
Charles, Salem, Oregon. Hey, Charles, go ahead, sir.
Yes, this is Charles. I'm listening on KEX.
Ah, great. Thank you.
And
power.
I'm curious, have you ever considered a gravitational field to be a time rate gradient structure?
Well, not really. You know, I think that, again, we have a very good theory, general relativity, given by Einstein, that explains how gravity works in the part of the universe we can easily observe. There's plenty of reason to believe that general relativity is not the final word. There's more that we need to know. But right now, you know, we're trying our best to find some observable place in the universe where general relativity isn't good enough, and we haven't found it yet. So, and I wrote a whole textbook, Space, Time, and Geometry, about how general relativity works. But I would love to write an updated edition because we found something even better. So far, that hasn't happened.
All right. Thank you. Lexington, Kentucky. James, it's your turn, James. Hi there.
Oh, thank you. Sean, I got an idea I'd like to throw at you so you can have your opinion. I'm not educated, so this may be in quantum physics already, or it may be just crazy. But anyway, my idea would explain how the universe, why it's symmetrical and why some of the weird things of quantum physics, like quantum non-locality, work. Okay. What would explain it is the small particles aren't part of time. Somehow they're void of time or not in the time dimension or whatever you want to call it. Okay, if that, you know, that would explain why quantum non-locality works. Okay, so if that's possible, then there's nothing to say that all the matter in the universe isn't made of one tiny little particle, because if it's not part of time, it can be everywhere at once or you know, at any given time. So, and that would explain the symmetry of the universe, because this particle would be, you know, everywhere. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. I think that it's very, very hard, you know, just to be very honest with you, it's very hard to come up with a new theory like that from scratch, because there is so much that we do know about the universe. And, you know, we have theories that explain quantum entanglement and the symmetry of the universe that are different. And, you know, it's a little bit of a downer when I say this, but I always tell people, you know, if you want to move beyond our present best theories of the universe, then you're not going to convince anyone to take you seriously unless you first learn and master the theories we already have. And so I love it when people are trying to come up with theories to think beyond what we already know, because that's what I do for a living, and I love it myself. But we do know a lot, and fitting in with all that we already know is the real challenge here. So if I were you, you know, buy some physics books, learn what we already know, see if you can fit in your ideas to the constraints that the data are already giving us.
All right, let's take, well, we may not have time for any more calls. It's going fast. Let's see if we can get Joshua in and Macon, Georgia. Josh, real fast, go ahead.
Yes, hello. I've got a quick question.
Sure.
What if that you have an object in time, not in time, but in our dimension, right? And it exists within our dimension, but it also exists within multiple dimensions. And when I speak of dimensions, I'm speaking of like other realms of sorts. And technically, if that object exists in the same space, here and in other dimensions, wouldn't that mean it's occupying the same space as like another
object? All right, we're going to have 20 seconds to respond, Sean. That's all we got.
Yeah, you know, when physicists use the word dimension, they mean a direction, not a place. So we don't think there's any other places in the universe where particles are. We think we have a description of the world that works all at once.
Sean, I want to thank you for being on the program, my friend. Sean Carroll.
Pleasure.
The Particle at the End of the Universe. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.